This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Martin Brady. Today is June 25th, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. And Mr. Brady, you are in Garland, Texas, and it is approximately 1:13 p.m. Central Standard Time. Sir, why don't we start with a brief biographical sketch of yourself. Could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood growing up?
I was born in Swearsville, Pennsylvania, 1941, mm-hmm. and I actually grew up in New York City, actually Staten Island, New York.
Okay.
And this is approximately 1943, and I continued on through there until I joined the Army.
Okay. So you were born in Pennsylvania, grew up in Staten Island. What do you remember about Staten Island, your childhood?
Oh, everything. I could.
Yeah?
Yeah. Even with the buildings there, I could still walk through the woods. And since they put the Verrazano Bridge up, it's just wall to wall. It's just like New York City.
Mm-hmm.
It's a waste of an island.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Including me in the family, there was 10, six girls and four boys.
Wow, large family.
Yeah.
Where were you in that place?
Second from the last.
Okay. Did any of your siblings have any military service? Did they eventually go into the service?
Yeah, I had two brothers, both in the Navy. One was a destroyer, mm-hmm. Greasy Toe, and the other one was a yeoman.
Okay. How about your parents? What did they do for a living?
My dad was he held two jobs. He was a locomotive engineer, mm-hmm. locally, not a long distance,
mm-hmm.
and he worked for Con Edison in New York.
Okay.
And my mom was a homemaker, so.
Okay. So your dad helped run the trains there on the island itself?
Yeah, he usually took trains from Staten Island, returned them to New York City or mm-hmm. Hoboken or wherever.
Mm-hmm. And then did he work Con Edison in the evenings? Or?
Well, Con Edison was his full-time job.
Okay.
And he took, the railroad time he could get.
Right, okay.
He worked himself up from a fireman to an engineer.
Okay. How would you describe your childhood? Was it an ordinary childhood, or was there something exceptional that was happening?
Well, pretty much so. I had the benefits of growing up in the country, mm-hmm. you know, around animals and, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of woods and ponds and lakes and
mm-hmm.
and being within a half hour of New York City.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to go into the city often?
Oh, very much, yeah.
Yeah? What are your memories of going into New York City? I guess Manhattan, I should say.
Well, it's, I got a parochial education. Mm-hmm. And a Catholic education.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, first of all, my first remembrance of going to New York was for a First Communion suit. Go up to 14th Street, up into the Garment District.
Right.
My mom bought me a suit for Communion, and mm-hmm. then a suit for Confirmation, and then a mm-hmm. suit for Graduation. And,
mm-hmm.
But probably the most vivid memories are when we and my buddies went up and raised hell up in Athens. You know, we'd hop the train and sneak into the ferry boat and mm-hmm. sneak into the subway and go up to the Museum of Natural History and
mm-hmm.
Central Park and then go down into Delancey Street and, you know, where the guys grew up
mm-hmm.
that moved to Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, just, you know, common boy pranks stuff.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Oh, heck, anywhere from 10 to 14, I guess, somewhere around 10 to 12,
mm-hmm.
somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your schooling. You said you had a parochial education.
Yeah.
How were you as a student?
I was a smart aleck. I really didn't like being enclosed. I didn't like the nuns didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
The religious aspect of it didn't bother me. I just didn't want to be in enclosed, and I didn't want to be, you know, held down. And I did enough just to get by, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't realize how important it was to have an education. My dad tried to beat it into my head.
Right.
Not physically, but, you know, verbally. You know, mm-hmm. he tried to tell us how important it was because
mm-hmm.
he didn't even graduate grammar school.
Okay.
And, I survived. I got along in New York. They have the Regents examination. You don't pass that, you can't go on. So I passed the Regents and, they didn't have a Catholic high school on our end of Staten Island, so
mm-hmm.
I went to a Catholic high school in New Jersey,
okay.
where the rest of my family went, too. So.
Okay. How about the rest of your family, your brothers and sisters? Were they also, were any of them more inclined educationally, or was this your personality that was kind of, you know, smart alecky and not wanting to dedicate himself?
Most of them were good students.
Yeah.
They were, you know, the whole family was reasonably smart. And most of them were good students, and most of the girls went out and became nurses, RNs,
mm-hmm.
Some 4 year, some 3 year. And they're all aggressive. They're not, you know, like they say New Yorkers get hired down in the South because they can hump. You know, they work.
Yes, sir.
And they're used to it, you know, and it's ingrained in them, you know, a good work ethic. I think that we all did pretty well.
Mm-hmm. How about in high school? Did you play sports?
No. I managed the varsity team for a while, and that was just to get in the games free, you know, the away games.
Which game? Which sport?
Basketball.
Okay.
And but, you know, being from Staten Island and traveling back and forth, you know, it got, you know, time-consuming, you know.
Right. How long a commute was that?
Probably an hour, I guess. You know,
wow.
It was scheduling. You know, you had to catch the train right to catch the ferry right, and then
yes, sir.
Run up the hill to get to the school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't really athletically inclined. I was too damn lazy. I was swimming and that kind of thing. We're only a mile away from the lower bay, and you know, not too far from Sandy Hook.
What kind of things did you enjoy doing as a kid for hobbies?
Oh, everything was, you know, swimming, fresh water, salt water, bike riding, woods, squirrel hunting, rabbit hunting, pheasant hunting, fishing.
I guess a lot of people today would not think of Staten Island in that way.
Oh, no.
Hunt and fish and...
No, Lord, no. Staten Island at that time in the late 40s, early 50s, middle 50s, you could trap animals, muskrat, make, you know, $4 to $6 a pelt. And I know my two brothers, before they went to school in the morning, they'd run their trap lines and still have to be in school at, you know, at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, the train, the ferry, and then running up the hill to the school.
Yes, sir.
But, yeah, it was outstanding. It was really good.
What kind of jobs did you have as a young boy? Did you work?
Yeah, I was pretty, I liked to work. I'd rather work than go to school, and I think that was one of the problems I had with, you know, being enclosed in a building.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember working for a fishmonger, and he taught me how to clean and scale, clean and fillet fish, and how to tell the difference, look for, you know, bad food and that kind of thing. And and the money I earned, I took it home and gave it to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then, naturally, everybody has a paper route. And I got gypped too many times, so I gave that up.
Mm-hmm.
And I answered the phone for a taxi service. And I think I got a quarter an hour or something, or a quarter
wow.
of a day or something like that. And then I made more in tips because I was accurate. I could take a message, and even if they were old, and, you know, I could talk to them and get the information that I needed to get the taxi there to pick them up, whatever. So
right.
That and I had a couple other jobs. I worked in a delicatessen, stacking shelves, delivering orders, and that was good because I had my own bike and I could move fast. And, what the heck else?
How about high school?
High school, I didn't do much because it, you know, a lot of travel getting over there, and then studying, and then, you know, in the parochial school, you got to wear a jacket and a white shirt and tie.
Yes.
So I washed my own white shirt every night, and you know, got my clothes ready for the next day, and pretty much then, you know, during the winter, it's, you know, it was dark at 5 o'clock. So.
Did anybody besides your brothers and sisters serve in the military that was in your family, your brother or your grandparents?
I had
uncles?
My eldest sister was, when the family was still living in Pennsylvania, to go to nursing school, she signed up on something, I guess it's like ROTC, and she received her nursing education through the military. But when she graduated, it was the end of World War II, and they were, you know, phasing everybody out.
Right.
And she never did get called up.
Okay.
So that was her.
Okay. Any uncles or?
Oh yeah, I had two uncles. One served in the Hattusha campaign, you know, the Aleutian campaign, mm-hmm. rather. And the other one, I think, I'm not sure if he went overseas or not, but the two brothers on my father's side, I think one brother on my mother's side served in World War II, and then one brother served in Korea.
Okay. Where I'm leading with this is, how much influence was all this on you to join the service?
Not really that much. I think the thing that got me interested in the military was, it was growing up and actually meeting World War II vets, both, you know, guys that had their stuff in order, mm-hmm. and guys that were mentally screwed up. And I can even remember one old dude was a World War II vet, and everybody, you know, said, oh, yeah, old, what's his name, was gassed, you know, he don't get along, you know. And mm-hmm. I met all these characters either in the taxi cab part of working mm-hmm. or in the delicatessen or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a small town where I lived, and they'd be sitting on a bus bench or something like that. Naturally, you know, you'd talk, you know,
mm-hmm.
you'd talk to these people and glean some stories from them and all. But probably that and just actually physically associating with the veterans and then, you know, reading. Everything then was, you know, magazines were mm-hmm. all Saga and, you know, all these gung-ho magazines and all.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned about Special Forces early on. This is long before I intended to enlist.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of sounded like a good idea and a good way of doing things.
How did you learn about Special Forces?
In a magazine. It was one of these exposés, you know. Mm-hmm. The government has these secret folks, you know, to do this and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kept my eye out, and if any material came along that involved that kind of thing, then, you know, I scarfed it up and read it. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think the regular infantry or the regular army, the Air Force, Marines, or whatever, it didn't get my attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that wasn't something I would just join the army to join the army.
Right. What year did you graduate high school?
In 59.
Okay. And was there an expectation for you to go to college, or did you want to go to college, or did you say, okay, military?
I got a job with a chemical company, and they would pay for my education as long as I maintained a C.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Wagner College at night
mm-hmm.
There in Staten Island, and I realized then that college wasn't for me. I'd rather be out making money, and you know, I was working, you know, sometimes two shifts a day, two and three, 4 days a week.
At this chemical plant?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you couldn't really concentrate on going to school at night and then, you know, worry about your job and,
mm-hmm.
You know, trying to schedule things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a withdrawal passing on the last course I took, and that was it before, you know, right, not too long after that I joined the Army.
Okay, so you joined, as you told me before we started recording the interview, in May 61. So you worked, what, a couple of years, I guess,
Yeah. Doing
this.
Yeah.
Tell me about the lead up to joining the military. What was pushing you to join and stop working?
Well, just that, you know, it had come to the fore about Special Forces and with Kennedy and all, and that was
mm-hmm.
a big incentive there, you know.
Tell me about that. Well, how did he influence you?
Well, it was just the whole operation. The fact that, oh boy, here we got a Catholic a guy that's going to be president, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's ex-military, and it just seemed like everything was gelling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been thinking seriously about enlisting, so it was not too long after that, and then I just decided now's the time. So.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents feel about that?
They had two boys already went in the Navy. They were Naval Reserve and
mm-hmm.
went active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't bother them. They didn't, whatever I wanted was, you know, their primary concern.
Okay. So they were supportive in general?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay. So tell me, when you decided to enlist, and were you able to talk about going into special forces at that time, or did you kind of have to go through infantry basic?
You couldn't get you. At that time, you had to have 4 years of service.
Mm-hmm.
A background in different fields, be able to speak a foreign language, or the ability to learn a foreign language, and several things that you had to accomplish, which was it was a good idea.
Right. I was wondering if you told the recruiter, this is where I want to go.
And oh, yeah.
If he had told you anything.
Yeah, I told him I wanted to start out with Ranger School and go to Special Forces.
Uh-huh. And what did he say?
He says, you're crazy. he says, look, stupid. I'm going to sign you up for Airborne Administrative Clerk. And I said, you're out of your goddamn mind. I ain't, mm-hmm. You ain't never going to get me to be a clerk.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but I'll take airborne. He said, okay, I'll get you airborne on the sign. But, the old stretch, I'll see if I can get it for you,
mm-hmm.
He had her paperwork made out already.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy's name was Saka. I can still remember it after all this time. I don't remember his first name because he was an E7, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I still remember him. He said, look, don't be silly. He said, you're getting in there. He says, if you go in there unassigned and you don't make jump school, they're just going to take you and send you to Korea or send you to Germany or mm-hmm. whatever, and you're just going to be cannon fodder. You might not even make the infantry. You might end up being a permanent KP somewhere or
mm-hmm.
something. So he says, let me sign you up. I said, nope. I want to, unassign.
So you took your chances.
Yeah.
You were pretty confident in your abilities to go forward and to make Special Forces.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me about your basic training. Where did you go?
Fort Dix, New Jersey.
So not too far away.
No. Nah.
Okay.
Everybody, north of Philly went to Dix, and
uh-huh.
everybody south of Philly, I think, went to Fort Jackson.
Tell me about Fort Dix and basic training. What was it like for you?
It was, at the time, it was, there's things you don't realize until you're in the Army later on.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was kind of what I expected, the regiment and regimental mm-hmm. and, a lot of rules and regulations and this and that, and I understood. And, they give you these little classes to explain why it's important, and it made sense, so mm-hmm. it really didn't bother me.
How did you adopt to the military lifestyle?
Pretty well.
Yeah?
I was rebellious, but mm-hmm. I never, willfully, did anything really bad,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long did the basic last?
It was 8 weeks, I think, Basic training was 8 weeks, and then the AIT was 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But, again, it's that the instructors and most of the cadre were all World War II and Korean vets.
Hmm.
So you were kind of in awe, again, of, this quality of man that, mm-hmm. that carried the weight and all this.
Can you describe what do you mean by that, quality of man? What did you see in these guys?
Sincerity. They really wanted us to learn to be soldiers. They didn't, just come in here to play grab ass for, 8 hours a day and then mm-hmm. go home and whatever. These guys were seriously about training us to become soldiers, and become effective.
Mm-hmm.
And that impressed me.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the they were from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, served multiple tours, either in Korea or World War II or somewhere else,
Did they talk about their experiences?
Sometimes, yeah. You couldn't get too close to them.
Right.
Because, it's the, superior, subordinate type thing. But
mm-hmm.
They did, present themselves, and in given situations, they'd explain why things happened this way
mm-hmm.
and how it either helped them or didn't help them or actually caused them problems,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But several had been wounded and had obvious, difficulties, and
mm-hmm.
That was the reason they were teaching basic trainings instead of being in, an active unit.
Right.
Is because it, for one reason or another, they were either wounded or got old or whatever.
Mm-hmm. What would you say was the most challenging aspect of basic training for you?
I never really thought of it as a challenge. They taught you well enough. They taught you what they wanted you to know, and
mm-hmm.
they couldn't test you on anything they didn't teach you.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, I paid attention. I did my homework, and I did what is expected of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have much of a problem.
Okay.
the unknown probably was more things to sweat, you know, because you read into things, you know, guard duty. Oh, man, this guy, you know, failed guard mount, and they threw him out of the Army, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in my family, shoot, that would be, you know, that's disgrace, you know.
Right.
And that was the only thing. It was just something that you don't know and they don't tell you about and you weren't planning on. And but, you know, once you've done it once, then it's not as, you know, you can start figuring things out. You start getting street savvy. And,
mm-hmm.
It just starts. It's initiation more than anything. You know?
Right. And getting used to the Army and
lifestyle. We had a lot of National Guard and Army Reserve people with us. We had one guy, I can remember his name, old Annibale. he's from Pennsylvania. The son of a gun must have been 45 years old.
Wow. He was in your basic class?
He was in my basic class because he had put, I think, 15 years in the Army, and mm-hmm. all he had to do was come back and do five.
Mm-hmm.
So he went down and talked to the recruiter, and they got him in. But, like I say, these guys have been in the National Guard, had all this prior experience mm-hmm. and all. So.
What kind of weapons training did you get?
Basic stuff then was M1 rifle,
mm-hmm.
A6 machine gun, hand grenades, bazookas, 3.5 rocket launcher. Infantry tactics, basic squad, and fire team squad and platoon infantry tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Digging in, defensive posture, offensive, enough to get you initiated, let you know why things happen the way they do,
mm-hmm.
and why we chose this way of prosecuting, you know, the war, you know.
Mm-hmm. How did you do with all of that? Or did you take to it easily? Or
it was pretty good, but they took the smarter guys, and they ended up driving a truck because they knew we knew,
mm-hmm.
you know, and... So you missed a lot of stuff, but basically it was informative, and like I say, you know, we weren't stupid, and we wanted to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So that was half of the battle. You know, a lot of these slugs didn't want to do anything. You know, mm-hmm. they wanted to get their 6 months in and get the hell back to Brooklyn. You know,
right? How much did your growing up in the, you know, in the woods and trapping and fishing and swimming and that kind of thing help you with your military basic?
If I hadn't have done that, if I hadn't have been really independent as a kid, I think I'd have, you know, I'd ended up, you know, somewhere in Germany or Korea.
Right.
Or the brig.
Right. Okay, so after these 8 weeks are up, where do you go for your AIT?
Well, it's right there at Dick's. All you do
okay.
is just move across the post,
mm-hmm.
and you go into advanced infantry training there.
Okay.
And it's during that time that they sent the Special Forces recruiters around.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in hog heaven, boy.
Right.
That guy come over there. Where do I sign? Don't tell me anything. You know.
Uh-huh.
And they gave us about a 2-hour orientation. Took everybody's name that was interested, and
mm-hmm.
And then I think even then that they figured that we knew what we were doing, because I think then they started initiation of paperwork for security clearance
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. So they were fairly confident. That, you know, the 5 or 6 or 10 guys, whoever did volunteer, eventually would make it, or at least get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then before that also, they had recruiters come in for airborne, 82nd Airborne Division,
mm-hmm.
and 101st. And, of course, guys signed up for that because, you know, they hear $55 a month, you know.
Mm-hmm. How far into the training did these recruiters visit?
That's probably halfway, somewhere around there.
Was it 8 weeks again?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it just, you know, really concentrated then on fire team squad and mm-hmm. platoon company, you know, on the attack and the defense and
mm-hmm.
different. And then I think too we messed around with mortars, 60 mortar, 81 millimeter mortar, just for familiarization because in a company level thing that, you know.
What kind of things were the Special Forces recruiters looking for, in your opinion, when you first met them there? What did they tell you?
They really didn't say what they were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
They told us what they wanted and what they were looking for. And then if we thought we had it, if we had the moxie or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then we needed to sign up and let them evaluate us, and they'd let us know.
What'd they tell you?
Basically, that, you know, it's not for... if you're just here for 3 years and go home to mama, then don't even consider it. But if you're considering the military as a career, and you know, you plan on spending 20 years or better, or you know, a good amount of years mm-hmm. with the military, then you might consider this.
Okay.
And of course, they showed us what it was all about, you know, how it was formed, and mm-hmm. but I think there's 10 or 15 of us ended up going down to Bragg, either for airborne or SF, or you know, the combination of the mm-hmm. two.
This is after you finished your advanced.
Yeah.
Went down to Bragg. Yeah, this is when Kennedy is really initiating a strong push for the use of special forces.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you came along right at this time when the government was really backing this. So when you finished your advanced training, did you know then you were accepted in special forces?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. When did you find that out?
I think just about the week before when they start, because then, you know, you're still a recruit and the personnel people don't have anything to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
If it had been in a unit, you know, you'd probably get wind of it, you know, a week or two ahead before they cut orders on you.
Mm-hmm.
So after they cut orders, the first shirt come down and read a list of people and where they'd be going. And
mm-hmm.
I found out that I'd be going down to Bragg.
How'd you feel about that?
Oh, I was elated. That was my goal. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
At least it was the next step, you know. At least I was closer to getting what I wanted.
Yes, sir. Is this still 1961?
Yeah.
Okay. So you go down to Bragg. When did you go down? This must have been, what, September or October?
October. We got down there, and I can remember it. It's I think it was October the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there, and we flew in on Piedmont, and they picked us up in a deuce-and-a-half truck. And on the way back from the airport, you go by the slave market downtown Fayetteville.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it then because we're sitting in there, and we had those, the garrison cap, or not garrison. Well, some of them had garrison. The other had overseas cap. The garrison cap is a big bus driver-looking hat.
Mm-hmm.
And the garrison cap is the kind you can fold and stick in your belt or
mm-hmm.
epaulette or whatever. And we're driving through Fayetteville, and there's this little old lady walking just like, you know, she's going to cross the street. And she mm-hmm. waited until the truck went by, and then she started walking across the street, and she yells at us, "Leg!"
Leg?
Leg is a derogatory term for non-airborne personnel.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, Fayetteville's a 82nd Airborne
yes,
town.
Sir. Yes, sir.
This little old lady, I almost dropped, you know, because leg.
What do you guys think about that? Well, welcome to North Carolina.
You know, first of all, what the hell is a leg? You know,
right, right.
Then we found out later. But,
yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, tell me, how long does Special Forces training last there at Bragg?
Oh God, for a medic, it's a long time.
Yeah. Okay. You did go into the medical corps. How did you become a medic? Why did you want to become a medic?
Everybody that had a GT score of over 110
mm-hmm.
and could walk and breathe and talk became a medic.
Okay. Was that okay with you, or did you want to do
something? Well, no, I wanted to be a demo man. I wanted to be a demolition expert.
Why?
Well, first of all, because of the results of what you do. You can
right.
see it, you know. You can
right.
really get a kick, you know. And I don't know. It seemed to be that, in my mind, he was one of the more important people. You know,
mm-hmm.
on the team,
mm-hmm.
and it's what I had, you know, envisioned myself doing anyway. So
mm-hmm.
that's what I had planned to do, and then of course you don't have a choice. So like I say, they did, cattle call or whatever they call it,
mm-hmm.
And then you line up and they say, okay, you got a GT score of this, you know, we're giving you, and it actually caused me a problem because. When we got to Bragg, we ended up staying overnight downtown in some flea bag hotel, and ended up taking a cab out to Bragg, and
mm-hmm.
we went out to the 82nd Repo Depot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is my first indoctrination to, you know, not open hostility, but
yes, sir.
You know, we got out to the repo depot, and the guys that were supposed to go there, actually, they took them in and, you know, passed them on. He says,
mm-hmm.
you guys, he says, you don't belong here. Get the hell out of here and go back down to Smoke Bomb Hill. So we ended up walking with all our bags and the, you know, duffel bag and all that stuff. We walked back to Smoke Bomb Hill because they wouldn't give us any transportation. Then when I got down to Smoke Bomb, signed into a unit, and I didn't know it, but we signed into a Psy War unit. And actually, it was a Psy War unit that was attached to 7th Group. So actually, what we were doing is signing into 7th Special Forces Group.
But you didn't know that.
I didn't know that at the time. So then they, you know, the next day they got us all out and processed us and all that. Well, 7th Group picked us up on a morning report. And when we got down to training group, which is where we were supposed to report in, we got down there and found out that some of us were on orders to go to Laos.
Already?
On Bright Star, yeah. Because they saw on my records that they had already, you know, put down my, I think it was 911 was the MOS code for medic. So they said, oh, hell, we need medics in Laos. Grab that kid, you know.
Right.
So they were going to grab me and a couple of the other guys and send us to Laos from Bright Star.
And how long had you been there?
2 days.
Had you been trained at all to be a medic?
No. They just, you know, because of your GT score.
Right.
Well, anyway, the first sergeant down there, training group, got it all squared away, and we made it into training. But now, in hindsight, I wish I'd have gone to Laos.
Okay, tell me about being trained as a medic there at Bragg. What
well,
did they do?
We didn't really get trained at Bragg.
Okay.
Bragg was just, we got there at a time when there was three companies. It was a Special Forces Training Group Provincial. And they had first company, second company, and third company. And I was in third company. And you report in, and they didn't have any room for us. So you're in class A's, and they drop you for 10, you know, push-ups and this and that. And if it's raining, you drop in the mud, and you do push-ups. You know, it doesn't matter because they don't want you there to begin with, you know, because they don't have room. There's nothing they can do about it. So if you, they get you to quit, then it's, you know, they're gonna, that's what's going to happen eventually anyway, you know, if you let that stuff bother you. So we finally got into and got settled in the barracks and all that, and then pulled details. Every morning you went out and had reveille formation, PT, and then they'd send you out on a detail somewhere to rake leaves or pick pine cones or do something, you know, just waiting for to find out where, who you are, where you are, and what they want you to do. And so also, first of all, you got a primary thing to get done is to get you airborne qualified. So they send you up to the gym up there on Smoke Bomb Hill in the 7th Group area, and Lionel Penn was a famous Ranger, World War II in Korea, and he had what he called pre-back, pre-basic airborne corps, and he'd get in there and he'd find the weaklings and get rid of them, and we'd go up there every morning and do PT all morning long, and go back and then pull details in the afternoon. And then, they didn't, you know, schedule you for any kind of a course until you passed the airborne course.
Okay. And how did you do with that?
Well, I had problems. When I got out there, what I considered good shape and what the Special Forces considered good shape wasn't the same thing. So Penn liked to kill me.
Okay.
Him and a guy named Bruchard. And, you know, I mean, it was rigorous. It was really tough. And
what kind of things did you have problems with?
Actually, mine, my hardest thing was running in formation. I just couldn't run in formation. And I had problems with the upper body strength. I didn't do push-ups or pull-ups right. They weren't chin-ups. They were pull-ups. And you had to do them perfectly to get to you never went, you never left pre-back until they were positive that you could pass that PT test right then. And if they had any inclination that you had a weak spot, or you didn't go, you just stayed there. So I ended up staying with Penn for 8 weeks.
Wow.
So he ended up trying to kill me because he had never had anybody there that stayed that long. So, but I told him, you know, the only way you're going to get rid of me is to send me to jump school or kill me. And he tried his best. But me and I think there was two other guys who were having problems. Most of those, they washed out.
Did he eventually cut you slack, or were you able to actually do it?
No, he actually gave me, he took Sergeant Brouillard And Brouillard got me to the point where he said, watch this. And he took me in and showed me what the hell these two rails, like what they call them. It's an Olympic event.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed me how to do push-ups on those and go lower than the actual, you know, where your chest would hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I did all my push-ups. I'd get foot lockers, 3 foot lockers,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way I'd do my push-ups.
Okay.
So by the time it came to do them right, I was aces. You know?
Right, it was a breeze for you.
Yeah.
Right.
And like I say, Brouillard was, Penn was wounded, had his arm tore up. I'm not even sure if he could jump at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He had his arm tore up in Korea. Brouillard had a leg tore up in either Korea or Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were still, you know, fantastic physical instructors.
Mm-hmm. So when you finished with that, you went to jump school?
I went to jump school at Prague with the 82nd.
How was that?
Oh, beautiful. That was great.
Can you give me a description of it?
Well, it was so regimented. You know, everything was like clockwork. If mm-hmm. you didn't do a clockwork, you ended up doing push-ups or squat jumps or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the premise of the school was to train you to jump out of airplanes and to do it in such a way that you wouldn't be a detriment to yourself or the rest of the people jumping with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a combination of terror, humor, everything. And it just so happens that in 1961 and 60, or January of 62,
mm-hmm.
the personnel that they had in jump school as instructors, they're world famous now. Bloody Burns,
mm-hmm.
Tomato Face, what the hell is his name? Sergeant. Two German brothers, they were lodge boys. Ostendorf,
mm-hmm.
I think their name was. But I mean, they kept you interested, and again, it was they wanted to instill in you what they had learned, and they mm-hmm. wanted you to learn and do it right, and you know that made it easier.
Right.
And they brought a lot of humor to it, which you know. Made things, you know, as harsh as it was, because, you know, you did everything in the rain, in the snow, and mm-hmm. whatever, and it was fun,
mm-hmm.
but again, grueling, because you didn't know, because on any given day, you could do something wrong, you know, and then you get demerits, or do this, or do that,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you sprained an ankle, or did something, your elbow, or, you know, got hurt, or something, mm-hmm. you still had a function, you still took your PT, and you still took your PT test.
It sounds like you were able to adapt to all of this and make it through this.
Yeah, they get you to the point where you do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they like they say, they tear you down to build you up.
Mm-hmm.
It just took longer for me to build up in pre-back than it did for the average bear, you know.
Mm-hmm. So how many jumps did you actually end up making? Do you remember?
You only make 5 in basic airborne course.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first jump we made was in snow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was impressive. And my first jump, I was the first man in the door, which was impressive.
Yeah? How did you do on that?
Oh, excellent. You know, I had no problem. Uh-huh. I just wanted to get out of that zone, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, again, this guy, Bloody Burns, he's a legend.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had a, you know, the Army's got leather gloves, and then they got a wool insert that goes into the leather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what he'd do is he'd fill that leather glove full of nickels and dimes and quarters, you know, and if you catch you sleeping, you know, you're sitting on that airplane probably for an hour before
right.
you jump,
right.
and you fall asleep. And he'd like to catch guys sleeping, and he'd nail them across the helmet with that glove full of quarters, you know,
mm-hmm.
ring their bell, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me a couple of times.
Yeah.
And being at first in the door, you know, they're supposed to just tap you on the butt, you know, and
mm-hmm.
go, you know. And you go.
Mm-hmm.
Old Burns liked a little emphasis, so he kicked me dead in the ass. I thought I took his boot with me when I left. You know? But little vignettes of stuff in jump school, you know, they'd have it all prearranged, you know,
right.
just to keep things flowing and keep it, you know, humorous and keep people, you know, interested. And they'd say, you go over, you see that sergeant over there, you go over there and tell him that you love his wife. You know, so you'd run over there and you'd have to be slapping your thigh on every left foot. You'd slap your thigh and say, airborne, airborne, airborne,
mm-hmm.
airborne. You ran everywhere you went. The only time you didn't is during lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
And you run over there and snap, and you got to call a guy's name. And what do you want? Sergeant told me, I love your wife. You love my wife. Get down and give me 10 push-ups. You know? And they'd send you to somebody else and say, you know, something else. It was a lot of fun. But you were still building muscle and still getting coordinated. And it was I think it was 3 weeks of ground school and 1 week of jump school, what actually jumping.
Okay. What kind of special weapons training did you have?
Then you don't really get exposed to weapons other than, you know, get you something to do, you know, weapons training itself. But then it's, you know, you draw your, you know, your weapon. You're assigned a weapon as part of, you know, the company. And then
right.
it was all M1s, and I think then they had 45s and K-bar knives.
Mm-hmm. So after you finished jump school, what happened?
Got back to the company, back to Crane Group, you know, full time. They don't mess with you.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that stay in the 82nd area, I think they can get messed with. But when we come back, they really didn't bother us because it was really rigorous, and you spend a whole day there every day. And so we'd come back, and then they'd schedule you. Once they knew you graduate jump school, then they'd pass you on to the next phase, which would be medical training.
Okay.
For me, I lucked out because in jump school, I got pneumonia.
Oh, yeah?
And they put me in a hospital for 10 or 15 days.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out, I went back and I took the PT test. I passed the PT test and made my 5 jumps and went back to the company. And it just so happened that they had a class starting in January down at Fort Sam Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got to go to the medic training.
Okay. So this was in January 1962?
Yes.
When you went down to Fort Sam Houston?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about your medic training.
Well, basically, it was just a basic combat medical training for the first 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, bandages and splints and vehicles and transportation of the wounded, setting up tents and doing this, triage. And it's just, you know, their way of training their medics to go to an infantry outfit or an artillery outfit or whatever and function as their medic.
Right.
So we take that, and then the second 4 weeks was advanced medical training. I forget what the heck they call it, but we call it blood and guts because the first thing that you go in there, they want to separate some of the people that ain't going to make it anyway. So, and they've got a bunch of Army training films of operations and autopsies and stuff like that. The first one, that they do a laparotomy. They open this guy's chest from his Adam's apple down to his belly button, and it's all in Technicolor, and they just splay it open, and this, you know, guy's got a pus cut anyway, but it flops open, and I mean, there's guys puking all over the place. So that made them think whether they wanted to continue.
How did you do?
Oh, it didn't bother me a bit.
Okay.
Like I say, well, I had 5 sisters that were nurses. And,
right.
Seeing blood as a kid, you know, broken legs and compound fractures and car accidents and stuff. But we trained actually with other people. It wasn't just Special Forces people. We trained with conscientious objectors and guys that were, you know, just going to be medics within a given unit. But once they found out that, you could either live with or it didn't bother you, the blood and guts and whatever. So that was a little more advanced. You learn a little bit, you know, about instruments, about suturing and the basic, hospital stuff, you know. And then the last 8 weeks, that's all it was training for their 91 Charlies, the ward master course, and working on a hospital ward. So it was everything that they wanted you to know in the, you know, the workings of a hospital and medical units.
Okay.
And then from there we went to OJT, on-the-job training, and several of us, I guess about 8 of us, went down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, because no one had ever been there before. And it was the helicopter center of the Army. So we got down there, and that's where we chose to go to OJT.
Okay. And what did you do down there at Fort Rucker?
Well, they assigned us to different wards to work with the, a given physician. And we'd work, I think it was 2 weeks on each section, like OBGYN, emergency room. Everybody loved the emergency room because, you know, they even went in and volunteered to go in on their own time just to get exposed to trauma. Because that's what, you know, that was going to be your...
right.
your bag when you got you know, trained and assigned.
Mm-hmm.
But we were the first folks through that. They were really sure of what the hell they were getting into by allowing these, you know, special forces, you know, trained killers down there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out we had a Captain Keller, Army Nurse Corps mm-hmm. lady that was in charge of us, our class, and another fellow that was he's either the son-in-law of Sergeant York,
mm-hmm.
or he was the grandson of Sergeant York. I wasn't sure, but he was an E6,
mm-hmm.
and he was a pretty good Joe. He was pretty level-headed. Mm-hmm. Again, he was interested in getting us going and getting us trained and getting a system set up in Rucker.
This was an 8-week program at Rucker?
Yeah.
Okay. How did you do personally with all this, rotating through these different departments?
Pretty good. I had one guy go under on me, old Bogus Paget.
Mm-hmm.
And
what do you mean go under on you?
He died, and I was his medic. You know, on my shift. You know,
mm-hmm.
the ward took care of him, but you know, he was my. You had to do a case study, and he was my case study.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot more time with him, not only on my 8-hour shift, but you know, on my own time going to interview him because he was in and out. And,
right.
But he was grossly overweight. Shouldn't have been operated on. They did a hiatal hernia. They cut him across the diaphragm, you know, across the rib cage.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor son of a gun, he just went from bad to worse.
Mm.
But he didn't make it anyway. But that was my first time with we had these World War II nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And they really didn't like us because they, you know, they were the closest thing to being doctors that the Army had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And these young pups coming here, getting all this good training, and they're going out and, you know, pull teeth and do this and
mm-hmm.
minor amputations and all this. And a lot of them didn't like it, and they made it clear that, you know, they were going to make life miserable for us if we didn't, you know, give them their pound of flesh or whatever. But anyway, this old, I call her old battle brain so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
But I respected her. She was a good old lady. And like I say, I was raised with a bunch of old ladies of this caliber, you know, and really strict and smart and mm-hmm. Didn't take any crap from anybody. And mm-hmm. it was her way or the highway. You know? But she actually wrote me up and wrote me a real nice letter, surprised hell out of me. Because
mm-hmm.
The first time I met her, I was in the emergency room. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm sterilized." She says, "What are you sterilizing?" I said, "I'm sterilizing the speculums."
Mm-hmm.
She says, "What?" And speculums, you know, they do a vaginal
mm-hmm.
inspection, and the sterilizer I was using was for, you know, surgical instruments
mm-hmm.
that they used in the emergency room. So she got all excited and, "What the hell, you know? What are you, stupid? You know, you got a missing gene or something?" You know?
Right.
So,
this was your evaluation that she wrote this nice letter.
Yeah.
What, okay.
Over and above, the course. This
right.
was just, she felt well enough to, you know, that she could write something decent about
mm-hmm.
one of the hoods, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that impressed me and, you know, give me a little more incentive. So.
Did you feel confident when you left this time at Fort Rucker that you were ready to go into the field as a medic?
Oh, sure, yeah. I was ready, yeah. There's no doubt about it. The guy, the CO, was a fellow named Spurgeon Neal, and he
mm-hmm.
wrote the Neal Manual, which is a survival manual for aviators.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really a savvy dude, and he took an interest in us because we were the first class he had,
mm-hmm.
and he assigned us a cardiac surgeon, and this guy later, I found out, left the Army, went to NASA.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, he had degrees out the left flank. Mm-hmm. And he's a young guy, and he didn't care about the Army. You know, he didn't care about the discipline and all that. All he cared about was medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the Army was a way for him to practice.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd have at least once a week, he'd come in and have a seminar. We'd go to PX, drink Coke, and he'd give us a class on this or, you know, find out where we were having problems and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was well put together, and they took good care of us.
Mm-hmm. How long did it last at Fort Rucker?
Eight weeks, I think it was.
Okay. And at this point, this is 1962. Is this when you received your orders to go overseas? Or
No. We finished Fort Sam in I think June of 62. Went to Fort Rucker, had 8 weeks there, so that would be July. We got back to Bragg and they have what they call branch training. Where you learn the special forces skills that they want you to know.
Such as what?
Cross training, you know, weapons, land navigation, intelligence, a lot of weapons, operating in the woods, and you know, all kinds of stuff. But it's, primarily, it's you know, to teach you special forces techniques and the background of special forces and that.
Right.
And they had to divide us up because there was a big bunch of us. So half of us went to what was then Dog Lab, and the other half went to branch training. So I was with the bunch that went to branch training, and that was, I think, 4 weeks of didactics and I think 1 week of field training.
What kind of things were they teaching you? Can you give an example?
Setting up drop zones, dead letter drops, live letter drops, passing information where people, ordinary people, wouldn't know you were doing it. And, demo raids and ambushes, training of indigenous personnel, the, you know, fingerprint identification systems, dental identification systems. We had everybody from World War II Rangers and OSS to foreign nationals, you know. It was really a good course, really. Again, these guys, these World War II guys, they enjoyed what they did, and they really wanted to impart the knowledge. This one, I remember, Sergeant Bazayan, and he'd be up at the podium, and, I mean, Bragg was hot as Hades, you know, and there's no air conditioning in the in the early 60s. So all you had was open windows and ceiling fans. And you'd be sweating bullets, you know, and the guys would nod off, you know. So old Bazayan would be up there giving his class. And the one classes that he had that he thought were kind of, you know, a Z machine, you know, that would kind of boring, you know. He'd dream up ways to keep your attention. And one of them, we didn't know it at the time, but he'd take a cigar and he'd straighten out a paper clip, and he'd stick the paper clip down the cigar. And then he'd make it a point of, you know, a flourish of lighting that cigar up at the beginning of his class. And he'd be teaching away, and that ash would start burning down. Well, you figured after the first inch, you know, the way he swings his hands and does all this, you know, that the ash would fall off. So everybody stayed awake waiting for this damn ash to fall off his cigar, you know. But they're still digesting what he's saying. And then later we found out that was one of his techniques to, you know. Another one was that something that he felt that he needed your complete attention. He'd have a brick there, and he'd say, you know, this is an M1A1 brick, you know, weighs 4.7 pounds. It's 8 inches by 4 by 4, and I want to pass it around now, and you can actually see it, and, you know, you pass it around. Yeah, it's a big brick. It's a heavy brick. You know? And the last guy that's at the field and heft it, he takes it back up to the podium. He says, okay, he says, now that you know that this M1A1 brick weighs and looks like and feels, the first guy that falls asleep is going to feel that brick right across his forehead. Well, I don't care who, somebody is going to fall asleep. Well, during the class, he takes a sponge and replaces it, the brick with the sponge. And the first guy that falls asleep, he flings that sponge. And I mean, everybody hit the floor. We figured this guy's going to die.
Right.
But that was another trick. And I mean, this guy, he was an OSS dude. And
right.
He taught us some really stuff. And like I say, it stuck with you after, you know, 30 years and 25 or whatever as a civilian now.
Evidently, yeah, you remember it to this day. Tell me about indigenous personnel training. You mentioned that that was part of the branch school.
Yeah. Certain things that, you know, people, you know, likes and don't likes, you know, people don't like to be touched or don't ever touch the person's head. Their religion you know, prohibits, you know, this and that. And, but
were they training you specifically for Southeast Asia or just in general?
in general, but emphasis probably on Southeast Asia, because that's what everybody was hoping to, you know, to make, you know, to get on a team and get assigned. Because mm-hmm. White Star was going on, they were already in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And had we finished our training earlier, if I had been a demo man, you know, in retrospect, thinking back, that's one of the reasons I wanted to be a demo, because mm-hmm. it was only 8 weeks, whereas medics were almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
I could have been, you know, actually got a mission to Laos under my belt,
mm-hmm.
where these other guys would still be in training at Fort Sam.
Right. Okay.
But, yeah, it was geared towards Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But it could, what they wanted you to know was adapt it to anywhere in the world.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was, they wanted more or less. And it was not only the sociological stuff, but they wanted to impress on you that, you know, just because you got this interpreter,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, and they actually went through a skit where, you know, the guy's using the interpreter, you know, and the interpreter's actually telling the troops, us, we're acting as the indigenous troops,
mm-hmm.
and the interpreter's, in, you know, just firing back in English. And actually, he's telling us what a dickhead, you know, the instructor is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just because everybody's nodding their head and looking and smiling and
mm-hmm.
having a good time, it's not necessarily the fact, you know, this guy
right.
could be telling him that, you know, you're no good and,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to chase his wife and whatever.
Right. So after these 4 weeks of branch training, where did you go? Did you stay at Bragg?
Yeah. Then we swapped with the other class. The other class
right.
went through branch, and then we went through the dog lift.
Okay. What was that like?
Oh, murder. It was, that was actually, the first 4 weeks is what they call the surgical phase,
mm-hmm.
or correction. The first 4 weeks is the didactic classroom
mm-hmm.
Stuff. And, again, back anatomy and physiology, but anatomy and physiology at a, you know, a college level.
Mm-hmm.
We had a guy named, he smoked a cigar, too. He was the OIC, and he didn't, he was like a college professor. He just
mm-hmm.
ripped through the stuff, and there was no asking him to slow down, or
mm-hmm.
you don't ask questions or ask for a repeat. You either got it or you got somebody after class and compared notes. But him and, he had another doctor, I remember his name, Dr. Ryan was second in command of the lab.
Mm-hmm.
But the first 4 weeks was all classroom, and then the last 4 weeks was all surgery.
Okay. How did you do with the surgery part of it? Were you actually performing the procedure?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of things were you doing?
Well, first of all, they issue you an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And from the date of issue, that's not an animal anymore. It's a human being.
Mm-hmm.
So you in-process the human being just like you would pull them in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. This is a dead animal. Or
no,
is it alive?
It's a live animal.
Okay.
Yeah. So you take him in and you give him a physical exam. You take
mm-hmm.
all his notes, you know, and just like a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start getting them healthy, you know, because these are all animals come out of a dog pound.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all fixing to get gassed.
What animal did you have? Was it a cat or dog?
Dog.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they'd go and get these out of the dog pounds. Rather than anesthetize or euthanize them,
mm-hmm.
they'd give them to us because at least they'd have 4 more weeks of life and a really good life because
mm-hmm.
whatever I ate, that dog ate.
Mm-hmm.
If I had steak, that dog got half.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody took good care of their animal. And they give you the first week, I guess, to where you can run your blood tests, stool specimens, and urine specimens,
mm-hmm.
find out what the hell's wrong with the animal before you begin. And give you a chance to get them healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, we fed them good, took care of them, and actually got attached to them.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, me being single, I had no intention of keeping the animal.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the married people would, you know, do their procedures, and then they'd take the dog home.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones that didn't make it, they were all, you know, euthanized and put in the incinerator.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it was fantastic. The team consisted of a surgeon, assistant surgeon, anesthetist, scrub, and a circulator, a five-man team
mm-hmm.
in the operating. We used open-drop ether, thiopental sodium to put them down first,
mm-hmm.
and then for the surgical phase, it was open-drop ether.
Okay.
Again, if you did anything that appeared that you were treating this patient as an animal and not a human being,
mm-hmm.
you left the class.
Okay.
They threw you out. Initially, when it's your turn, when you're the surgeon, it's mm-hmm. your animal that's going to be wounded.
Mm-hmm.
You take the dog, the patient, and you give him an IV. You get an IV started,
mm-hmm.
and then you knock him down with the thiopental sodium. And once you're reasonably sure, you know, you got certain things you look for, eye movement, pupil size, and different things like that will indicate the level of anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
So they get them down to, I forget where there's a second, third level of anesthesia. And, at that time, you take them out, and they've got a special chamber set up with a Russian carbine. And they shoot the dog in the fleshy part of the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And then from then on, he's a wounded human being.
Mm-hmm.
So after the chamber's cleared, the team rushes in, gets the animal, brings it back, and you commence. You start the open-up ether,
mm-hmm.
put them under. Get them under to, you know, for surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do a debridement on the wound.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, once the debridement's done, you know, everything's, you don't sew up the wound. It's what they call a delayed primary closure.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave the wound open, but you're not allowed to use antibiotics. All you can do is use sterile technique and soap and water.
Mm-hmm.
And, then, you know, you bring the dog or the patient back up, you know, where he can navigate and put him back in his cage. And then for the next week, then you're, you know, taking care of him,
mm-hmm.
changing dressings, cleaning the wound. And then after, I think it's 7 days of, supposed ward treatment or whatever, then you do a delayed primary closure on him, and you actually open the wound,
mm-hmm.
and sew it up, and then after that you do an amputation. If the dog's going to be euthanized, they do the amputation. Everything is done under, you know, surgical anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, a lot of the guys wanted to keep their dog, so mm-hmm. you'd have one dog and then use all four legs. So the guys could take their dogs home whole, you know.
Right.
So it was good for the dogs, and
mm-hmm.
it was definitely good for us. The initial animal of choice was rabbit,
mm-hmm.
because the circulatory system was more akin to human.
Mm-hmm.
But there was small, and it would have taken longer, and I don't think people would have enjoyed treating a rabbit as a human than they would with a dog. You know?
Right.
So, and then they stopped using dogs because people complained and
mm-hmm.
said, you know, it's a vivisection or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
so they started using goats.
Okay.
And they found out that they could take a herd of goats and put them out in the animal storage area, and they eat the grass and procreate, and
mm-hmm.
they didn't have to pay $40 a head like they did initially, you
mm-hmm.
know, that they could raise their own goats.
How well did this prepare you for combat surgery?
Oh, excellent,
yeah.
Excellent. It was really, because part of the procedures you actually do in training, you learn to do what they call a cricothyroidotomy,
mm-hmm.
and actually, when you know, before you even get the patient ready with the injectable anesthesia,
mm-hmm.
you actually put a tracheotome, the throat tube into his lung,
mm-hmm.
or into his throat to keep the airway open.
Right.
And you actually perform a tracheotomy on the goat. You do a thoracentesis, which you actually take fluid out of the lung through the rib cage. You actually what the heck else is there's several procedures that you can do while they're under. and everybody gets a chance to do them. And many a man has given mouth-to-mouth or mouth-to-stoma to a dog to keep him alive, because if you fail, you're out too. And by fail, if the patient dies, you fail.
Right.
But, practice nerve blocks, different techniques that, you know, you can use. And, of course, during a class, you know, during a class, you learn by doing it to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Drawing blood, finding veins, examining a prostate. You know, it's not the most enjoyable thing in the world, but, you know, at least when it's done to you, you know what the patient feels like, and you really know what to look for.
Right.
And it's really, to be able to just know instinctively what to look for, and to do it by rote, you know, just go into it and get started. It was invaluable. And the teamwork involved, because if you're a good surgeon, you're a good surgeon. But if you got a bad anesthetist, you could lose the dog just by not, you know, paying attention.
Right.
And he's busy, you know, because if you cut nerves or arteries that you're not supposed to, that's another, you know, demerit. So, and of course there are mishaps. The guy didn't put the leg that's going to get wounded. He didn't put it in the cradle right. And the dog gets shot in the leg. Well, you got to amputate. There's no way, you know, you can keep the animal in a cast for that short a period of time and expect to get any results from it. But there were, you know, mistakes that way. So the guy got his amputation early, so he was free, you know. But most of the time, it worked like it was supposed to, and. Like I say, it was just outstanding training. And then the people that taught us were, again, they wanted us to learn. They weren't there just filling time. And that's, you know, the way Special Forces operates. You know, they're there to impart knowledge, and they do.
Were they still washing people out of the program at this late stage?
Oh, sure. Our honor graduate was a young black dude from 101st, Darrell C. Bishop. I still can see his face. He snuck off and went to his hometown over the weekend, and his buddy was going to, change the bandage and wash the wound. And Dr. Huey was the main mug. But he came in, and the bandage hadn't been changed, and his buddy didn't do it. And he was the honor graduate. He had the highest scholastic marks and the highest proficiency marks. And he got shit-canned. They put him out.
Wow.
And a guy named Foodie ended up being honor graduate. He got a foot blown off and numb.
So after this 4-week training period, what happened next for you?
Then you earned your Green Beret. Then you got your hat and your orders to group, or some of the guys that were, you know, they didn't have much time left and they had their stuff together. They kept them in the dog lab to teach, or they put them somewhere to teach or whatever. But at that time, they needed people on Oki, and everybody wanted to go to Oki. Everybody wanted to go overseas. They needed people in Germany, and I think four of us out of the whole class ended up going to the fifth group, which had just opened up. They opened up in September of 62, I think, became activated, and I ended up going over there in December of 62, got actually assigned to an A-team.
Okay, and where were they stationed?
At Bragg, right there on Smoke Bomb.
Okay. And is it with this group that you went to Southeast Asia?
Yeah.
Okay.
At that time, they were sending people TDY from the 7th, the 1st on Okinawa, the 7th at Fort Bragg, and then the 5th. And they had a lot of people, you know, filled in from, you know, all the groups, actually, you know, from overseas, Germany, Okinawa, and the 7th. So there was a lot of experienced hands.
How soon did you depart for Southeast Asia?
I reported in December and got assigned to A-26, and we left for Nam the following June.
Okay. Okay, so you were there at Bragg for about six and a half months before you went overseas.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Brady, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Sure.
All right. Sir, could you tell me, what were your duties from December 62 to June 66 there at Bragg before you went overseas? What were you actually doing?
December 62 to 66.
Excuse me. 65 to 66.
Okay, 65 to 66.
Yeah, when you were there with the 5th Group at Bragg before you shipped overseas.
Okay. I shipped over in June of 62.
Okay, so 1261 then to June 62.
Okay. Most of it was run details, but from mm-hmm. January 63 mm-hmm. to before we left, it was all pre-deployment training. It was all raids and ambushes.
So hold on, January 63?
Yeah.
Okay.
We left for Vietnam the first time in January, June of 63.
Okay. I have my dates confused. All right. And so from January to June, you guys did?
I reported in just before Christmas, 62, and it was all details and getting in processed and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had one field problem, went to the field, jumped in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a 5 or 6 day deal or something like that. Came back and then everybody split for Christmas leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then in January, we started in earnest the pre-deployment training.
Okay. Can you describe that to me?
Oh, it was great. It was a lot of cross training, teaching the other team members medical stuff. They taught us COMO and demo and intelligence,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
weapons. A lot of emphasis on weapons.
What kind of weapons training did you have? This is did you know you were going to Southeast Asia, first of all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That was the ultimate goal, you know, to train well enough and be accepted on an A-team.
Okay. And so what kind of weapons training did you have?
Small arms, mostly submachine guns and mm-hmm. That type of thing. Crew serve weapons, 81 mortar, mm-hmm. 60 mortar, grenade launcher, correction, mm-hmm. not a grenade launcher, then it was still the bazooka.
Right.
The 3.5. Demo, firing for proficiency, with the, then it was a M2 carbine.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the, then that, right about that time is when the Stoner system was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to sell it to the Army, and I think the Army turned it down. I think the Navy eventually bought it.
Mm-hmm.
But, then when the first time we left for Vietnam, it was M2 carbines was the basic arm.
Okay.
Attacks and ambush, escape and evasion, just about a little bit of everything, as much as we could.
Was the training good?
Oh, yeah. Not only the training was good, and realistic,
mm-hmm.
but you got to work with your team.
Mm-hmm.
These guys had been, you know, this just like me, the younger guys anyway, had been sent off to school, training somewhere, and actually we got to function as a whole team, I think, in January or February.
Mm-hmm.
And as it would turn out, one of the guys that he turned up being my senior medic on that trip was mm-hmm. A guy that was in my class.
Okay.
So I knew him well.
Okay.
The other guys that the commo man, he had been in school, and the demo man, and he'd been in school. So it was a feeling out period to get to know them, and what they knew, and how you got along with them, and where you could improve things or whatever.
How many men were on the team?
A 12-man detachment, 2 officers, 10 enlisted.
Okay.
Captain is a team leader, infantry officer most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was almost exclusively infantry. XO, the same infantry, more or less then he was more, the administrative man.
Mm-hmm.
Then a team sergeant, usually an E-8. It was the team daddy. He took mm-hmm. care of discipline, organization, running the team, and the liaison between the officers and the enlisted men.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had one intelligence sergeant, usually an E-7,
mm-hmm.
and then 2 medics, 2 COMO, 2 demo, and 2 weapons. Okay. Light and heavy.
Mm-hmm. And so you trained with this one specific team, so you guys got to know each other well.
Yeah.
Okay. And when did you actually get your orders to go overseas?
Well, I guess probably April or May, mm-hmm. we knew exactly where we were going. The team leader, Captain Yoder, mm-hmm. Got in touch with Captain Aldrich, mm-hmm. who was on the ground in Vietnam. He was the man in charge of the team we were going to replace. So, actually, we were pretty well abreast of what was happening in April or May, maybe even before,
mm-hmm.
of what was going on in the camp that we were going to. And so, you know, we had the opportunity to, you know, to apply some of the training mm-hmm. to specific areas that we were either light on mm-hmm. or where we wanted to really get down and dirty.
Mm-hmm. Where were you going exactly?
It's a little village called Long Phu.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the right near the border of the Chung Tien and Ba Zuyin province mm-hmm. in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And the team before was a TDY team mm-hmm. that we relieved was a TDY team from Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And before them, it was just Father Tong. He was kind of a Catholic warlord. One of Ziem's people down there in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a Vietnamese Special Forces team assigned there. And before the team from Oki got there, they got hit by the Viet Cong, and they had this stuff in order, and this one intel sergeant on the VNSF team got their ashes out of the fire and saved the day. But that's, you know, Long Phu, that's what it's noted for, not for anything we did.
Right. But, okay. So you knew beforehand this is where you're going.
Yeah.
And you knew your mission.
Yeah.
What was the mission?
Actually, it was a combination of missions. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to go there. And, again, area pacification, win the hearts and minds of the people,
mm-hmm.
Prosecute the war and kill as many communists as we could,
okay.
and, you know, while doing everything else.
Right. How are you supposed to pacify and win the hearts and minds? What specific instructions were you given?
Well, as medics, we pre-planned a medical program,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we knew what the medic in place was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew what we had to do when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
But we also had to keep in mind that we were there to close that camp. Our mission was to close the camp
mm-hmm.
and go build a new one in an area closer to what we wanted to accomplish.
Okay.
So
closer to the Cambodian border, basically?
No. We were in the middle of the Delta.
Ah, okay.
See,
okay.
We were halfway between Kamau and I don't want to say Makwa, it's not Makwa. We're halfway between the A team in Kamau and mm-hmm. the B team in Kanto.
Okay, so when you say move closer to your mission.
To where the communists were.
Ah, okay, fine.
A better position to interdict. And,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But again, when we got there, it was a TDY team from Okinawa that mm-hmm. we replaced. Excuse me. The priest, Father Tong,
mm-hmm.
was, you know, deep into the politics of the region, and mm-hmm. he was his lips to Ziem's ear type mm-hmm. of arrangement. So
mm-hmm.
I think he knew that we needed to move out of there. So he went in to Ziem and told Ziem, hey, keep this team, you know, here in my compound, because mm-hmm. if they leave, then I'm going to get attacked and taken over and whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he said, okay, and the Americans said, okay, we'll leave them there for a while and see what happens. So
mm-hmm.
we ended up staying the 6 months here and a short time down in Sok Trang.
Okay. Before we get there in detail, your preparations at Bragg before you go over, you said they were quite good. And they did they prepare you well for living there in the Delta and carrying out your mission?
Pretty much. like I say, it's geared toward, you know, where we were, we didn't have trucks.
Mm-hmm.
The only vehicles we had were sampans and engineer assault boats. So, vehicle ambush would mm-hmm. be a whole lot different.
Right.
You know, riverine-wise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the theory and the thought, you know, of how this could happen and how we apply it here and mm-hmm. The way, you know, we reacted as a team, that training was invaluable.
How much training did they give you on the South Vietnamese culture, or the Vietnamese culture in general, of how to actually interact with civilians?
Well, you know, our people did a lot of reading on their own.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of literature out at the time. The culture-wise, it was, see, what they call culture. I went to language school.
Okay.
And I went to, just as a to get it in perspective, I went to mm-hmm. the Vietnamese language,
mm-hmm.
I went to Korean language, and I went to Japanese language.
Okay.
Well, the Army's version of language is how you communicate with the swill. I mean, with the swell, not with the swill.
Okay.
So
right.
We're not sent over there to talk to lawyers and doctors and you know, important politicians
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. We're there to get the grassroots people,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
people to get their hands dirty.
Right.
And if we applied what we learned in language school to these people, they'd say, where the hell are these folks from?
Right.
You know? So the training we got, and we trained each other, was more or less getting down to the Hamlet individual and
mm-hmm.
how we can get them and impress them and,
mm-hmm.
Not really impress, but, do our job, you know, just mm-hmm. to convince our way is better and then, you know, the emphasis, I think, was everything was Zim, you know, that
mm-hmm.
if we did well, it was because we were, you know, Zim wanted us to do well, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, he wanted the, his people to get help.
Right. You're basically promoting
yeah.
the indigenous government there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it didn't bother us because, you know, we were getting our job done. And,
mm-hmm.
I lost track of what the original question
was. Well, let me ask you this. How did you feel personally about going into a war zone?
Oh, I loved it. I was with a great bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm.
We were well-trained. We trusted each other. And that's what we put all this time and energy into,
mm-hmm.
is training and be proficient. And first of all, we got selected. You know, we were going. We were a go team.
Okay.
And that's a, you know, feather in your cap.
Yes, sir.
They had their pick. There's a lot of folks that they could have chosen, you know, and left you out. But
mm-hmm.
first of all, we were picked. We were going, and we got orders, and we're going there. We know what we're going for. And we know
mm-hmm.
what we're going to do reasonably sure what we're going to do when we get there.
Right. Now, you were the 5th Group. Which unit individual again?
Charlie Company.
Okay.
C Company, 5th Group. Then it was, you know, just they didn't have battalions and
right.
stuff like they do now.
Okay. And you shipped out in June, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And how did you actually get over to Vietnam?
KC-135 from Pope Air Base.
Uh-huh.
And stopped off in Hawaii. They gave us 2 or 3 days in Hawaii to get acclimated.
Mm-hmm.
Then from there we went to the Philippines, and we RON remained overnight there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Air Force likes to buy furniture, I think, so they place their order on the way over and then pick it up on
mm-hmm.
the way back.
Right.
Get rid of us. But, yeah, we stopped in the Philippines, spent a couple days there, and then we flew into Saigon.
Okay. What were your first impressions of Saigon when you came in?
Well, you know, having not, you know, really traveled a lot, but I read a lot about the Orient.
Mm-hmm.
It was the smell, the sight, the... And then you have to remember it was a more relaxed war. You figured Saigon was like New York, you know. It was the country's capital, so
mm-hmm.
you were, you know, pretty well secure. And,
right.
But, you know, in the back of your mind, you know, the French were here, and they, you know, kind of thought like we did, you know. And you didn't want to, you know, jump in and make all kinds of friendships, you
mm-hmm.
know, because... you don't know who you're making friends with.
Mm-hmm.
But the immediate thing was, you know, the people and the smells and the sights, you know, looking for, you know, the bathrooms, you know, street vendors, you know, different things.
Mm-hmm.
It was, but we had accepted that. We knew that, you know, things are going to be different. You
right.
know, it's not like you were, you know, going to be hard. Oh my God, look at that! You know,
was it close to what you expected?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think they also got the pictures. I think too that Tiny Aldrich has sent to Captain Yoder. I think he's pretty descriptive of what they expect. And then of course from the medics and the, you know, we got a little bit of blurbs of information from all the MOSs. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was. And it was a simpler time then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the war hadn't really become a war yet.
Right, right.
So
this is the summer of 63.
Yeah.
And tell me at this time, what did you know about why the United States was in Southeast Asia and why we were back in the South Vietnamese government?
Well, we were familiar with the domino effect. You know, we
right.
knew that the stuff had been going on in Laos, and I didn't get a chance to go to Laos, and I knew that, you know, from talking to people that did go to Laos, and, you know, how things worked, you know, with the indigenous and, or, you know, the local people, and what to expect and what to look out for. And I felt confident that I could do it. I thought I was pretty street savvy. And I thought the other guys with me were all equally as, you know, street savvy.
Do you remember what they told you about Laos, what was happening there?
Well, the big thing, the Laotians had a lot more, I think they wrote a lot of their actions off to religion or politics or whatever, you know. But it was the old story about, you know, they change uniforms, you know, this in the daytime and that in the nighttime. You know, if they don't want to fight, they just aren't going to fight. They'll just put on civilian clothes and leave. You know, they can come back tomorrow and get the same pay. And different things. And, you know, you hear it about every war or conflict. Korea was the same, you know. Korean Binjo ditches, and they eat dogs and rats. And Vietnamese eat dogs and rats, and Chinese eat dogs and rats. You know, but you know, stereotypical stuff. But we, I think, had a little more insight in what we were going with because we were prepped by the team that was in, you know, in country on the ground.
Right, right. How long did you stay in Saigon?
Oh, mercy. No, I think we just landed there, and I think they either refueled the aircraft. No, we no. They went back to the Philippines. We got on a 130 and went up to Nha Trang, which was the C team, the headquarters at the time. So we flew up there from Saigon on a 123 or a 130.
And how long did you stay up there?
I think the better part of a week, because we went in, I think we made a jump or two jumps, zeroed our weapons, got some classes, got some money, got some, you know, time downtown, ate a couple of good lobster restaurants up there. It's right on the ocean. And then we flew back to Saigon, and they split us up then. The people who were going to Delta, I naturally got on one aircraft. People going up in, into three corps or two corps or whatever.
Okay, and so you, is that when you went on down to Long Phu?
Yeah, we flew from Saigon to Canto by fixed wing, and then by H-21 into Long Phu.
Okay. What was it like when you first arrived there?
Well, it's, you know, primitive. It's, you know,
small village.
Yeah, very small. Right on the main canal, and a lot of intersecting canals, and, you know, a lot of rice and a lot of banana trees, and pretty much, you know, what we expected.
How long did you end up staying there at Long Phu?
6 months.
Okay. And you've already talked about what your mission was. How did you guys carry that out?
Oh, God. Well, Kipfer and I were the two medics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a good medical program. We inherited a good medical program from the medics that were there before.
Where did those guys brief you? Did they brief you at Nha Trang, or did they brief you when you got to Long Phu?
All three places. They got briefed in Saigon on the tarmac. We got briefed at in Tent City at Nha Trang.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went back down at Can Tho, they briefed us there.
Okay.
And then actually the people that were leaving briefed us in camp.
Okay.
Again, you know, we had a good civil affairs thing. They had, had a movie projector. We showed to people, you know, films, American films.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved that.
What kind of films did you show them?
Most of it, you know, John Wayne and, you know, emotional stuff, you know.
Right.
That you could look at and glean something no matter what language,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. This was an effort to win the hearts and minds, basically?
Well, that and to entertain people. That, you know, they didn't have much going for them, you know, because at night, you know, the Viet Cong owned the AO, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, it, you know, it gave them, you know, kids especially, they just love that stuff. You mm-hmm. see a fight, and, you know, people fight with their fists and not kicking each other.
Right.
That kind of thing. But, that and, you know, everybody in camp loved it, too, because mm-hmm. in the camp, you know, we had 12 Americans, I think 12 or 13 Vietnamese Special Forces,
mm-hmm.
the priest and his entourage, he had about four bodyguards.
Mm-hmm.
But the strike force that we had, most of them were all Cambodians.
Really?
Yeah. We had five companies, and I think four of them were Cambodian Mountain Yard
mm-hmm.
or Khmer in the other one was Vietnamese and Chinese.
Hmm. How would you use the strike force?
Pretty much like infantry, you know, camp defense,
mm-hmm.
Perimeter defense, and then, you know, camp defense on the outside, ambushes and probings and raids and mm-hmm. Whatever.
Okay.
And then we patrolled the canals. We had, I think it was three engineer assault boats that we had Twin Evinrude CIA motors on,
mm-hmm.
noiseless motors, and then we had, I think they were Johnsons, 40 horse Johnsons,
mm-hmm.
and we mounted machine guns on the front of that, and we'd patrol the canals, and then hold med caps, you know, while we were out.
Mm-hmm. Would you patrol at night or during the day or both?
Not by boat at night.
Okay.
We had set up ambushes, and naturally patrols were, you know, you're out there night and day.
Mm-hmm.
You're away from camp for 5 days or whatever.
Right.
And 5 days, I think, was probably the usual.
Okay. What would you do on these five-day patrols? What was a typical one like?
Probably leave at night or early in the morning, get to a designated area, and then whatever your main function is to, you know, deny them the use of the area, or, you know, you've gained intelligence that, you know, these people are collecting taxes in the area, the people are pissed. And,
mm-hmm.
Depending on what, you know, the initial mission is. Mm-hmm. But we always kept, I think, two companies out, always, doing something.
Right.
Because, you know, the best offense is, the best defense is a good offense.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, you know, the companies we had, I think one company was 80 to 100 people,
mm-hmm.
and had, you know, World War II weapons, all interchangeable ammo, you know, the machine gun, the rifle, and was all interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
They had 60-millimeter mortars, 81-millimeter mortars,
mm-hmm.
M1 rifles, M2, M1 carbines, and that type of thing.
So very well armed.
Oh, very well.
Now, how did the Vietnamese get along with these Cambodians?
Well, they were in control.
Right.
They paid them, so they had them by the balls.
Uh-huh.
You do or you don't get paid.
Uh-huh.
So, but they were happy-go-lucky people. I think back, you know, and I've worked with the Cambodians a lot, and they're just the joy of life, you know. They get, you know, three slops and a flop, you know. They got all their meals paid for, and they get, if they, you know, kill the guy, they get paid for it. They get a bounty on it.
Mm-hmm.
They captured a weapon, they got bounty on that. And,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, the family was there, you know, and they just enjoyed life. And they enjoyed, for them, I guess it was being mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
But the Vietnamese were in control. They were, well, even they were kind of shady because you have to remember Diem at this time was in power.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a Catholic, and he's brought these folks down from North Vietnam and sent them down into the Delta and do this and do that. And the Vietnamese Special Forces, a lot of them are ex-Viet Minh that fought the French.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not completely trusted, mm-hmm. plus being Buddhist or, you know, Cao Dai or Wao mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right.
That they're not completely trusted by the priest or by the regime or whatever. So there was a little, you know, animosity, say, or, mm-hmm. you know, at least some mystery, you know.
Mm-hmm. How did you all feel about them? Did you trust them?
I trusted the ones that I associated with. Mm-hmm. The ones I didn't trust, I didn't associate with.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed away from them, or I insulted them to where they didn't come near me anymore.
What do you mean? Give me an example.
Well, Vietnamese are affectionate people. They're
yes.
The Americans describe them as effeminate.
Uh-huh.
It would be nothing to see men walking down the street holding hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a stigma. It's not looked down upon. Lay in the same bed, two or three guys taking a nap, all in the same sack. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're not, you know, homosexual, or they might be, or, you know, it doesn't matter, but it's not looked down upon.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a necessity because, you know, the absence of beds or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or hammocks or whatever. Two guys in a hammock is not unheard of. Some of the guys were just out for money, you know. They and especially being a medic, you had to be really astute to you know, find out things and not to ingratiate or you know, to piss off these folks, you know. But you need to know the difference between helping someone and giving them a handout that they're going to take and sell or
mm-hmm.
trade for something or, you know, whatever.
Right.
But the ones we had, some of them were outstanding. Some of them were just slugs. But, you know, you knew them because they knew them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even the Vietnamese didn't associate with the guys that I didn't like. So, you know, I guess my choice of people or personnel mm-hmm. is halfway astute anyway.
How would you rate the effectiveness of the South Vietnamese Special Forces?
At that time, it was a completely different Special Forces. Like I say, some of them were ex-Viet Minh. Some of them were political appointees.
Mm-hmm.
I think the guy that we had, in hindsight, talking to Captain Yoder, the guy was pretty savvy, and he had a good grasp on military tactics and
mm-hmm.
all. And he wasn't apolitical, but he wasn't really a regime person.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't a rebel either. But I would say most of them were pretty competent, and if they weren't completely competent, they were a little competent and a lot of confidence.
Okay.
And I think they knew that they were in control at that time. You know,
mm-hmm.
the Americans run the operation because we had the purse strings.
Mm-hmm.
But they had ways of getting around it. If they didn't want us going somewhere, they could find a way to, you know, circumvent certain areas or
mm-hmm.
things or whatever. And, but the ones that I liked that I think were outstanding, that the ones that, you know, I worked with or had dealings with, I thought were outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
They were well-trained, well-motivated, had good morale, and they were just honest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could look them in the eye and like an American, you know, or, you know, like your teammate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, with a grain of salt.
Right.
They're doing their job, you know.
Right.
They're not here to please us.
Do you think they understood why we were there, why the Americans were there helping?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Okay. Did you ever have any conversations with them about this?
Oh, sure. We'd talk. Some of them, well, like us, too. I never let on that I went to language school, that I could understand what some of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in the dispensary, we tried our best, Kipfer and I, to, you know, understand as much of the medical lingo to mm-hmm. find out, you know. They would talk. Because another thing is that, excuse me, the interpreters we had
mm-hmm.
weren't Vietnamese or Cambodian. They were Chinese.
Really?
Ethnic Chinese
okay.
living in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still in contact with three of them right now.
Really?
Yeah, we had there's one guy living in Houston. Another guy, he lives in D.C., but only 3 months of the year. The other time he's in Saigon
mm-hmm.
or Ho Chi Minh City.
Mm-hmm.
He has a business over there. And the other two we know made it out also.
Mm-hmm.
But one guy's living in near San Francisco, and the other guy has dropped off of the world somewhere. He's off in one of the third world countries, I think.
And this is just from these 6 months you spent there?
Just from the 6 months.
Wow. Okay. Describe what the base camp was like.
Oh, God. A mud berm on the side of a canal. the team houses were wooden tree structures.
Mm-hmm.
With beer can tin
mm-hmm.
For siding, some screening on between the beer can tin. I mean something like 4 foot by 8 foot, like plywood, but it's made out of they threw it out. They couldn't use it for making beer cans, so mm-hmm. they left it in 8 foot by 4 foot sheets.
Okay.
To use as roofing or siding.
Mm-hmm.
So that was on the side, and then some type of screen. Up from there,
mm-hmm.
and then a banana leaf roof. And the newest building in the camp was the dispensary, and that was brick,
mm-hmm.
really American-type brick, up about 4 foot, 5 foot, and then it was screened. And then we had a tin roof, I think, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't, it was banana leaf.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the newest building in camp. Okay. We also had a Catholic church. We also had a convent
mm-hmm.
In the camp. We had four or five nuns.
Okay.
And like I say, I think the one boundary was the bigger canal, and then another boundary was a canal, and then the rest were all going into the jungle, primary
mm-hmm.
jungle.
How many men would stay in one of these hutras?
Oh, hell's bells. See, we try to keep, it was like a long-term hot bunking.
Mm-hmm.
We keep two companies in the field. Naturally, they would maintain their quarters and all.
Mm-hmm.
But each company held about 80 men, and I think we had five barracks. So,
okay.
And they had less than we had.
So you slept in there with all those guys?
No, no, no. Okay. We had a team house. The priest had his own concrete two- or three-story building
mm-hmm.
that had been there since the French were there.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in there in his entourage, and about maybe 50 feet from that was the American team house. And then across from the American team house was one of the barracks, and then next to the team house was the barracks. And we had 10 or 9 guys living in the team house,
mm-hmm.
which was also the commo room and the talk and all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then me and Kipfer and Spies stayed in the dispensary,
okay.
which is about 50 yards from the team house.
Mm-hmm. How did you all first encounter the enemy?
Actually, the team sergeant went out on the first operation with the other team.
Mm-hmm.
And him and the captain went out with the captain and the team sergeant from mm-hmm. the other team, and they encountered some folks, and
mm-hmm.
I guess they ran away or whatever. But they got shot at and made contact, and he came back and told us about it. And everybody else wanted to, well, who's next? Let's go.
Mm-hmm. How about you for you personally?
Actually, probably the first contact was not eyeball to eyeball. It was a lot of weapons fire, but the poor son of a gun was going from a tree line across a paddy.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it at a wrong time because the company saw him. What we called the Tom Bow was like an intelligence squad that we sent ahead. They were dressed in like the VC in black pajamas and
mm-hmm.
straw hats. And
mm-hmm.
they concealed their weapons, you know. And I think that was the first encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, they probed the camp a couple of times. And then I think we went down, stayed with the district chief one time, and they roused us up down there. But, you know, like I say, it was nothing really close or any mm-hmm. pitched battle. Or probably to the south down there at Kamau, the camp down there,
mm-hmm.
they were actually making contact with organized units, you know, company-sized units.
Mm-hmm.
And the people we had, and what I learned later, they said that ours was kind of like a medical R&R center.
Huh.
You know, they didn't want anybody making contact.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, just try to keep us away from their base areas and give up, you know, the ancillary stuff or the skirt stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we never did make a really big contact, like I say, other than getting probed or
mm-hmm.
the camp itself. And we had some people get ambushed in the boats. But as far as big units or any kind of a big pitch battle, no, we never,
okay.
not on that mission.
What particular incidents come to mind when you think back about those 6 months there?
Oh, mercy. Well, there's a lot. The way we worked as a team, the friendships we made, the animosities we we picked up, and it's actually doing, taking part,
mm-hmm.
and accomplishing things, and that camp down at Kamau, which is the only camp south of us, that's where Roe and Pitzer and Rocky Versace were captured.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left, Captain Yoder, when we got to the B team to process out to go back to the States, Captain Yoder says, "Hey, my team wants to volunteer to jump into the U-Min, which is the U-Min forest,
mm-hmm.
to go in and try and free those prisoners, you know, because
mm-hmm.
they figured that's where the Viet Cong had taken them, to the U-Min." But everyone to a man volunteered. And that's married men, you know, with kids, and
mm-hmm.
everybody wanted to go home, but... everybody to a man volunteered. Yeah, we'll jump in there, do what we can to get them out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot from about people. I learned a lot about medical stuff, especially.
Tell me about some of what you did medically.
Well, we had the dispensary. They had built the Jim Chapman, Dallas Chapman,
mm-hmm.
was the medic there before me,
mm-hmm.
and his junior medic. His name escapes me, but Chapman. I guess they built that dispensary, and they had a constant sickle all morning long. They came from miles around. They took motorized sampans to get
mm-hmm.
down there to go on sickle.
Mm-hmm.
There were people from district. People from province would come there because they knew they could get reliable treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, parents would bring their old folks or the young kids or whatever. But anyway, Chapman had this medical program set up. We just inherited from him. And one of the things I learned from Chapman, and this guy, again, you know, he teaches people because he wants them to learn and do. And we had had some dental anesthesiology and some dental theory.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, cleaning and scaling and that kind of thing, but not any kind of dental surgery. But when I got down there and I got with Chapman, he says, "Come on," he says, "let's go out, take you out, and I'll show you some stuff." So we ended up going on some med caps, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, the stuff he taught me was invaluable. I mean,
yeah.
we made a lot of friends just in dental surgery and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we had we set up Chapman had set up a situation where tuberculars, TB patients, had a lot of leprosy, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, mingling in society, they were lepers, and there was no stigma.
Right.
But the TB people, we were actually, we scrounged streptomycin and NAS and PAS. PAS and two drugs you have to have if you're going to treat tuberculosis. And we scrounged that, and we had a process where these people would come in every Wednesday or whatever the heck it was, come in for their shot of strep,
mm-hmm.
and get their pills. But it was regimented. You know, we keep track of everybody, and we kept records on everybody.
Right.
The lepers, there wasn't much we could do other than, you know, just confirming that it was leprosy that was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, there was nothing we could do other than, you know, teaching them how to, you know, not be contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, one guy, he was in the strike force, he had leprosy. And the arch of his foot was eaten out with it, and, you know, he showed signs of leprosy. And we sent him on H21 up to Canto to get a blood test
mm-hmm.
to determine if it was leprosy.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, in fact, I flew out with him. And when we got up there, the guy told me, he says, "What's the matter with that guy? What, he shot?" I said, "No, he's got leprosy." Hell, if you'd have told me that when we were flying up, I'd have thrown his ass out.
Hmm.
I said, "Oh, well."
How'd you feel about that?
Well, as you know, I didn't expect anything that abrupt. You know?
Right.
But I could understand, because he's from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
These guys were over there for 90 days as door gunners
mm-hmm.
for the helicopter outfit. And, you know, over there, oh, Molokai, you know, boy, oh, Hansen's disease or that kind of, you know,
mm-hmm.
highly contagious or something, you know, and they didn't want to get an association with that at
right.
all. You know?
Right, right.
But like I say, it was normal sick call, and then,
mm-hmm.
like I say, med caps, we'd travel around, Kipfer and I, you know, different, I'd go one time, he'd go one time.
Mm-hmm.
But we rotated missions, we rotated patrols, and everybody got their chance.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, we had, you know, we kept tabs on it just so we could justify the amount of aspirin and different things that we ordered, penicillin, and we'd have a medical report we'd make every, and we were treating, you know, 1,000 people a week.
Right.
And some of these people were, you know, we knew obviously there were people coming in there saying they were sick, and they'd get the medicine, go trade it or sell it,
mm-hmm.
or give it to the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you had to treat them. You know, we got to learn, you know, how to talk to them,
mm-hmm.
you know, get the information from them. And of course, you know, you like, again, the street savvy aspect of it, you had a thing in your mind of what people looked like. You knew repeaters that came in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were treated well, and we set up a really good dispensary, if I say so myself. We sterilized everything. We had a sterile atmosphere. We had, you know, it was a really a good setup, and we were proud to turn it over when we did turn it over.
Do you feel like you were accomplishing the mission of winning hearts and minds?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We made some people. Like I say, the interpreters. It within the last few years, but we've reunited with them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, and the LLDB, the Vietnamese Special Forces, I ended up serving with the Camo Man again in 1964 and 65.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy is aces. He's not only a good Camo Man, he's got a good fist, he's got a good knowledge of communications,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, how to get things done in adversity, but he's just a good human being.
Mm-hmm.
And we served together in another camp in three corps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I knew him from, you know, he walked up, I could tell him, it's just like, you know, a long lost brother.
Right, right. So when the 6 months were approaching the end, were you reluctant to leave? Or?
No. Well, there was two things that happened while we were getting ready. And, you know, we had also sent pictures and, you know, the general you know, they could get our after action reports mm-hmm. there from the headquarters in Bragg.
Right.
But, well, we were, the only communication other than through military channels that we had was a transoceanic radio. One
okay.
of those big old bulky things. Every team had one mm-hmm. in a team room or a team house. And they come and woke us up once and told us that Kennedy had been assassinated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that we didn't know what the hell to expect. The Vietnamese Special Forces kind of locked themselves up, and we kind of locked ourselves up.
What do you mean, locked yourselves up?
Well, we didn't know. I'm sorry. It's Kennedy was already... No, Diem.
Diem was killed first.
Killed first.
Okay, okay.
That's when we locked down, went to the mattress. And
what got a kind of a defensive posture and waited?
Yeah, because we didn't know what they were going to do.
Right.
They didn't know what we were going to do. And
was there a degree of mistrust there?
No. It's just that the information that their headquarters was telling them,
uh-huh.
what they were telling us,
uh-huh.
that, you know, might have been different. We don't know. But just the fact that their president had been assassinated, and I'm not sure whether they knew something was, you know, involving the Americans mm-hmm. or something like that.
Right, right.
We're not sure what information they got from their headquarters, but we were prepared if they had tried to, you know, take over the Americans or whatever. But anyway, it was not only we had two people come back from Saigon that were there during the riot
mm-hmm.
afterwards, or mm-hmm. you know, during the curfew time, and but you know, eventually they smoothed things out. Everybody just went back to work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then when Kennedy got killed, and,
mm-hmm.
They came over and said, "Hey, the president's been shot." You know, I say, "Sure, he's been shot. He got shot in October." You know.
Right.
But yeah, that was a blow.
How did you feel when you heard that Kennedy was killed?
Oh, devastated. You know, how could this happen in America?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Abraham Lincoln maybe. You know, in 1865,
mm-hmm.
but not in 1963.
Right.
You know, in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah.
Couldn't happen.
Uh huh.
You know. And then.
Did it affect the morale of the guys?
Not that way. I mean, it was just like, you know, a relative passing. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're a little stoic maybe, or mm-hmm. you know, but no, the morale was good.
Okay.
But we just couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm. And this is a month before you go home.
Yeah. That happened on the 22nd,
mm-hmm.
and we left the 15th of December.
Hmm. Okay. And did you go right back to Bragg?
Yeah.
What was the mood of Bragg like in December?
Oh, well, not only that, because we got back, and we went through a week of medical evaluation by Walter Reed,
mm-hmm.
and then we went on leave.
Mm-hmm.
And Bragg again, you know, it's so cosmopolitan, you know. There's people from all over creation,
right?
There, you know, and you got you know, like the people in Dallas, you know, you didn't get it fast enough, you know, or you know, Joe Cracker, you know, or
mm-hmm.
so it ran from that to the, you know, people were really emotionally upset about it,
mm-hmm.
and you know, going back. I was going back to New York, my home of record,
mm-hmm.
and I think I went by train. And you know, you saw all the stuff, and the you know the black crepe, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there was a lot of things to worry about at the time, so we really didn't know. We knew it happened,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't know the circumstances. And then the immediate thing was to secure what we needed to secure and do what we needed to do. To, you know, continue the mission at the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know. But we really didn't get everything down probably until we actually got home on leave or, you know, spent some time with the people other than, you know, going through the medical
right.
stuff.
Right. So back with your family, it
yeah.
hit home more, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What did you, when you left Vietnam and came back and you went on leave, did people talk about Vietnam with you? Did they want to know what you had done and where you were?
No, my dad didn't know where it was.
Really?
Yeah. And several people. They knew what was going on over there because I remember seeing the highlights in the movies with the French, you know, the Foreign Legion over there. And so I knew Saigon, you know, and I, you know, could compare something, you know, even before we went over there, you know, the how the people looked, how they dressed, and what the terrain was like, and that kind of thing. But most of the people, like I say, it was not a war yet.
Right.
It was a training mission for most people. Although, you know, it already had people killed. Marchand and Gabriel were killed in 62. And
did you get a sense when you were there in South Vietnam during the six-month period that the South Vietnamese forces could actually defend their country and be a viable force there without the Americans in force?
Well,
I mean, this is before we came over in mass, but I mean, so you didn't really know at the time that this was going to happen, but looking back, did you think that they could defend their country on their own?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, we considered that going over, and, and if they just needed some help to finesse things, you know, learn some tactics, learn how to organize or do something, you know. I definitely believe that they could. But remember, in this instance, there were third country nationals as the armed force. So had these people get, you know, if they got dissatisfied with the LLDB or something like that, which happened later on in the war, they could have waxed them and, you know, just went home and taken the cash or whatever they wanted and just left. But, you know, they were, for, you know, just a bunch of peasants, you know, from Cambodia and some mount yards, even from Tukor.
How did they all get along with each other?
Outstanding. We, you know,
of course, there's financial incentive, as you said. But
yeah, well, they're you know, for food and clothing and cover, you know, and a lot of them were just there to earn money and send it back to Cambodia or back to their family. But you know, a lot of they had what they call pock time. You know, you eat your noon meal if you ate a noon meal, and then they'd have pock time. You'd sleep for a half hour, an hour, take a nap in a hammock or something, and then go back to work because you know it's it helps you through the day. Well, we'd go out and play volleyball with these Cambodians.
Okay.
And you know, we just as aggressive as they were. We wanted to, but them communist summer guns, they, you know, they were so good. They'd play three men against our five because we were so, you know, slew-footed or, you know, cumbersome, you know.
No, you called them communists. Were they
communists? I called everything was communist.
Okay. Why do you do that?
Well, it's just, it started in, I think, 1965. We, you know, it's just, you know, if it didn't work right, if it was bad, it was communist.
Okay, so, I got you.
And we all wore, you know, like a ring. You know what a ranger tab is? We had, some tabs made up saying, F period, U period, C period, K period, communism, and wore them on a uniform.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Did that ever get any reactions from people?
Yeah, laugh, you know. That's what it was meant to be. Hell, they had guys had tattoos made, Sat Kong, Kill the Kong, tattooed on them. But, you know, they were kind of extreme.
Right, right. So when you're back stateside, how much leave did you have?
They gave us 30 days, I think.
30
days leave and then came back.
What was it like going home as a Green Beret?
Oh, it was great. It was, you know, when I got off, you know, again, landed in LaGuardia, I think, and had to take the subway and whatever, and the ferry boat again and the train again. And, and I remember, I think it was in 63 when I got home because it was December, and I think it was about a foot of snow on the ground. I didn't have an overcoat, but it was just so beautiful, just, you know, everything was the season, you know, just prior to Christmas, and getting home and in uniform, and I had just made Buck Sergeant in December, November, December. But you know, everything was just so clean and pristine, and and the road wasn't even—I don't think there couldn't have been one or two cars that traveled the road.
Wow!
And it was just so delicate, you know.
Very different atmosphere from where you had just come from.
Sure.
And how long after you went through Christmas and you had your 30 days, you went back to Fort Bragg?
Yeah.
Okay. What did you do?
I went right back into mission training.
Okay. And when were you next deployed over?
December of that year, okay. 65. Okay, we got back in December of 64, and I redeployed as a company, not as a team. We went PCS, permanent change of station, in 60. You know, you went on a rotation, A company, then B company, then C company. Mm-hmm. And they did that for TDY teams.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the TDY teams, after they said, okay, the 5th is moving over here in total.
Right.
So then I think B company started the first PCS moves, and then Charlie company. And our time came up, and we left on the 15th of December.
Okay.
I think it was the 15th of December, 64.
Okay.
Because we spent Christmas in Makwa.
Okay. During this year, you said you did mission training. Was it the same kind of training you did before?
Yeah, more or less. And there were other things we had to do, too. We had, I remember in January, February, and I think we went to Fort Devens, Mass. 2 times on a composite detachment. We were opposing the 5th Infantry Mechanized, 2nd Battalion, 5th Infantry Mechanized.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that was the CO of the battalion used to be Special Forces, and he wrote back a request asking for an A-team to be aggressor, to train his troops, you know, against unconventional warfare.
Right.
So we went up and raised hell with him. And his name is Major Hope, I remember, because he thought he had us by the Jelonies. And the last thing we did was to leave a note. And they captured all of us but two.
Uh-huh.
One guy went into the Cranberry Bogs, and they wouldn't go in there after him. Okay. And the other guy, I forget why the hell they didn't catch him. But the last thing we did was to... it was pretty prophetic at the time, because we made a human bomb when they captured us, and we sent him in, and when he got interrogated, he handed a card to Major Hope and said, "You've just been blown up courtesy of a blah, 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 5th Special Forces Group." He said, "Oh, shit." The most obvious thing, you know.
They didn't check him.
Yeah.
So. Okay. I'm curious, with the knowledge and experience you brought back with you from South Vietnam, did you do any training yourself of other companies, of other Special Forces?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because immediately when we got back, you know, we had the requirements of the Army, too. So my senior medic came down on orders to go to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
So he left in January or February and went to Okinawa. Ray Spies, one of the weapons guys, he retired when he got back. The other guys, some went to Halo School, some went to Scuba School, some went to, you know, Split for the Four Winds. Some got out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Thompson got out of the Army. Fred Waters got out of the Army. I split with another team, went to Devens twice and a couple of other places. We went down and trained, went down to Bowbridge, Louisiana, and to Mississippi, I think it was Biloxi, Mississippi. No, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And trained some Army Reserve folks there in medical and, you know, like we talked about, branch training and, you know, things about Vietnam, stuff that they wouldn't have access to, you know, there in the States, you know.
Right.
When they go active for their 2 weeks or whatever, then they did have access to it. But they just wanted us to go down and you know, give us a realistic a picture of what was going on. And that went all through the South, all, you know, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas.
Had you made a decision at this point to make the Army a career?
Yeah. I had to re-enlist in May of 1964. And I got to thinking, you know, well, I'm out of here. I'm, you know, this is fine and dandy, but I'm going on to bigger and better. And I started, you know, to getting rational about it, and I thought, and I, well, what the hell are you going to do? You're going to go back to New York, and just like every Irishman from New York, you're going to be a cop or a fireman, and all you're going to do is change uniforms. And here I made E5 ahead of schedule, and like my boss said, you know, my senior medic, he says, Brady, he says, you know, you've always... had plenty of time in grade to get promoted. You just never had enough time in service.
Mm-hmm.
So I was either promoted with my peers or ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, what the hell, if I go back and become a fireman or a cop, I just got to start all over again. So,
mm-hmm.
hell, I'm going to stay in the Army and enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And do you regret that decision, or do you think you made a good decision at the time?
No, I think it was the best decision I ever made in my life.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. How did your family feel about you re-enlisting?
Oh, they all for it. They, okay. You know, he's found an itch in life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, anything else that we should discuss before you go back over to Southeast Asia? What, anything that happened of note there during the training?
Just pretty much the way I said it, you
okay.
know, to just mission training and mission support and these flyaways down to, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do another training.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you go back in December 64, and tell me where you're stationed,
where base camp
was.
Actually, our mission was to go over and build a camp.
Ah, okay.
So we flew into Saigon and then went up to Nha Trang, the same route.
Uh-huh.
The C team was still up in Nha Trang.
Uh-huh.
And we came back to a place called Mak Wa.
Uh-huh.
It's about, I guess, maybe 100 miles west of Saigon,
uh-huh.
up near the Cambodian border.
Uh-huh.
And there was a TDY team there also from Okinawa.
Hmm.
And
same situation as before.
Pretty much, except they still had a month or so to go on their mission.
Uh-huh.
And we were just sandbagging. We were just there to share, you know, live there for a while
until mm-hmm.
we can get our stuff right to get out and build a camp.
Mm-hmm.
So we got there in December 64, stayed with them until January. And I think January, half of the team moved down, and in February, the rest of the team moved down to where we were building a camp.
And where was that?
That was in a place called Tuinyan, A4415. And they sent us, I think, 15 CBs to help, with the heavy construction.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 12 Americans to start,
mm-hmm.
and 14 or 15 CBs.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, they sent us two more Americans as CAPO, Civil Affairs, Political Officers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when we start building the camp in earnest.
Was this another six-month mission?
No, this is a year.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're deployed there for a year.
Yeah.
And you were to build a special forces camp? Or,
yeah.
Okay. How, tell people listening to this and reading this in the future how one goes about building a special forces camp in 1964 in Vietnam.
It was in the Delta. The uh-huh. camp was being built about 85 miles west of Saigon
uh-huh.
on a main canal.
Okay.
And the if you can think of the Pacific Islands being a foot over sea level,
mm-hmm.
the place where we were going to build this camp, because it had a good proximity to a flight strip,
mm-hmm.
was, you know, if it had a good rain, the place would be flooded. So we had to dig. They sent us a couple of bulldozers, and we, you know, intermingled with the CVs and got the, dug up a pad,
mm-hmm.
elevated, I guess, about 4 foot above the tidal level,
mm-hmm.
and got the pad laid, got it compacted, and then we started vertical construction. And it's basically a rectangular fort,
mm-hmm.
and our replacement team leader, went ahead and scrounged a bunch of concrete, so we got the walls built and capped them with concrete. We used 55-gallon drums without the bottoms. Use those for the foxhole or the fighting parapets along the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, you know, once we got the walls built, we could concentrate on vertical construction
mm-hmm.
inside the camp, building barracks and
mm-hmm.
the team house and the combo bunker and the medical bunker. And it's time-consuming, and, you know, we not only had to work building the camp, we had to provide security, which is outgoing security.
Mm-hmm.
It was 16 clicks to the Cambodian border.
Hmm.
But again, we had those boats and machine gun mounted
mm-hmm.
on the front, so we
mm-hmm.
could do that. Plus, we still ran med caps and did other things, so
mm-hmm.
it was a heck of an experience.
How long did it take you to build the camp?
Oh, it was a couple of few months, I'd say. I can't
okay.
remember, but the CBs were there, and like I say, they did the main mainstay, and then we relieved them on the bulldozers and the dump trucks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they got all the framework built for the barracks and all like that. And one of those Delta winds came down, blew everything down.
Mm. Oh, boy.
And we naturally had a little surface rivalry over that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we got it up and done, and we're all during that time we were running operations.
What kind of operations were you running?
Search and destroy, interdiction, had a lot of canals, and we eventually got airboats. So we got a lot of intel. We had our intel sergeant had really had a good net going, and
mm-hmm.
we could, do a lot of damage to them by getting their tax collectors and keeping them from bothering the people.
Explain how you would actually go about that. What would you would receive the intelligence on the fact that they were being taxes being collected on a particular village?
On a particular series of villages,
uh-huh.
or one village, or on a specific waterway.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, they had their own means of E&E to get out of there should we venture in there.
Right.
But most of the time, we'd set it up like we were going out for, a five-day operation or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Get out, usually leave around midnight or very early in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and go to a pre-designated spot, set up, eat, and then branch out from there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it might not, the Americans and the VNSF might not have the same idea of where to do it, but ordinarily you could talk to them and say, hey, look, we're out here to get somebody and to do some damage,
mm-hmm.
hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they come around,
Were they reluctant to actually do some damage?
Well, they didn't have much to say about it. They had to, do what they were told to do. And
mm-hmm.
if the CO told them, don't go in this area, they weren't going into that area,
okay.
even though we wanted to. But
who was more in charge, you guys or the Vietnamese Special Forces?
Of where to go,
yeah.
and when to come back and stuff, probably the Vietnamese.
Okay.
But when the shit hit the fan, it's usually the Americans and the VNSF. It depends
mm-hmm.
on the caliber of the VNSF you had with you,
mm-hmm.
who actually took charge.
Mm-hmm.
But,
let me ask you quickly before we continue. What difference did you see in the VNSF this time around versus the last time you were there?
Well, they didn't seem as dedicated. They were newer.
Mm-hmm.
I say newer, younger. They were letting them in like me,
Mm-hmm.
I was let in early. I should have spent 4 years in a line unit before I was allowed in Special Forces,
Mm-hmm.
But, some of them were excellent. They were just young.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no inclination of independence. They couldn't do anything but follow orders.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was their livelihood. They lived or died by what happened, And it showed. These old guys, the old street-savvy Viet Minh, ex-Viet Minh type people that were
mm-hmm.
comfortable on the ground, they weren't afraid of being stabbed in the back or, somebody finking on them to the headquarters, this guy's, talking wild, or,
mm-hmm.
And there was more involved. There was a lot of politics involved.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I say, they were either good or they weren't any good.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell the difference right off. I could, and
right.
my team members could.
You'd been there before, you could
yeah.
tell. This is still with 5th Group?
Oh, yeah. 5th Group, once they went PCS, mm-hmm. it was all 5th Group. No more TDY.
Okay.
And unless it was for special projects.
Still Charlie Company?
Yes.
Okay. Well, go ahead and continue. So you would set up, you would eat in the morning, then you'd fan out.
Yeah.
What would happen from there?
Prior intelligence, they'd have certain areas that the NVA Viet Cong would use as way stations.
So you would actually try to catch them in the act?
Oh, catch them, yeah, with their pants down if we could.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we did many times. In fact, Tuyen Yan I think they were the first to log in that they had killed Chinese. Chinese advisors. These guys were 6 foot tall.
Right.
But this is later on in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
In the fall of 65.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to overrun the camp there. And it was. But see, the thing is it's a Delta again, slogging through those rice paddies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And he'd want so bad to walk on the dikes, you know, but, you know, right. Big, tall American walking on a dike, you know, he's a perfect target.
Mm-hmm.
So you slog through the water, you know, you slog through the rice paddy, and, you know, and 16 clicks to the border is a long way to slog in the mud.
Yes, sir.
So,
Did you ever encounter any strange wildlife?
Oh, yeah, God, yeah.
Like what? Tell me.
Oh, now this is, I can't remember if it's a Tuinan or it's at Loch Ninh, but these big lizards.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you work with these guys, they're, you know, cambodes and, and yards, and, you know, they need some nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you hear this stuff clackety, clackety, clack. It sounded like a damn tank coming through the bamboo.
Right.
And what it was one of these big, huge lizards. And, man, the tail section of the formation opened up on this lizard. I mean, it just like it was Tet, you know. But they were trying to kill that lizard for dinner meal, you know.
Right.
And, holy, yeah.
I mean, how big is this thing?
Oh, it's about 4 foot. It's a huge monitor, like.
Okay.
Not the Komodo dragon.
Right.
It's not that big, but big enough to, you know, the tail would feed a whole company.
Wow.
And, I mean, it even shot one of their own people.
Really?
Yeah, the tail gunner. He got shot, got wounded. We had a medevac, put him in a boat, sent him back. But, yeah, that was funny. And the heck was a... Well, there's a lot of little things that I just can't think of them now. But,
How about snakes?
Oh, snakes are food.
Yeah?
Good eating, no fat, you know. Easy to cook, easy to clean.
Mm-hmm. What kind? How would you catch them, and what kind were you
most eating? Most of them were just rice paddy snakes or whatever. You know, they had these little bamboo vipers that, you know, two stepper, yeah,
right.
Two steps and you die. And I never heard anybody dying of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
But they're too small to eat anyway, so people just ignore them.
Uh-huh.
But they are a hazard around kids. You know, if they're looking for warmth or something like that, they can sneak in on a kid. And,
right.
And if a kid panics, then they might bite them. But again, they're rear fanged and they're like cobra. You know, he's got to chew on you and get a good lucky bite.
Mm-hmm.
But they eat rats. I eat toads. I never think I'd eat frog legs, but I'd never ever think I'd ever eat a toad.
Wait, you said you ate rats?
Rats, sure.
Uh huh. How would you catch and cook and clean a rat?
Well, we didn't catch them.
Uh-huh.
See, that's more or less your headquarters element.
Uh-huh.
You got the American and usually two Americans. And usually two Americans will be, you know, displaced in the formation.
Mm-hmm.
One guy will be, and only one American has the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually the senior. But with the headquarters, you usually have one American, the VNSF, an interpreter, and then what we call a company commander or a platoon commander, the indigenous, the guy that speaks the language and has been trained as an infantry officer. So that's usually the headquarters. That's where you find out what the hell is going on, where you're going,
right.
What they think is there, and how to circumvent any kind of a bad thing happening to you on the way to the objective.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, they don't go out and kill things. They send their boys out to, you know, they throw a hand grenade in the canal and get fish, or, you know, shoot the lizard or catch the snake or get the rats. We had a rat eradication program there at Long Fu, and you pay them for each tail that they bring in.
Hmm.
And then, we just threw the tails away. Well, the kids would go get the tails and come back and get
Right.
The second time. So we made them bring the whole rat in, you know.
Uh-huh.
But then we were depriving them of food, so we said, okay, keep the rest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was, you know, just a one of those civil affairs projects.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, there was Americans like chicken eggs. Well, if, you know, you got 12 Americans, that village is going to run out of chicken eggs real quick.
Yes.
And, so the you end up eating duck eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But the Vietnamese would eat the duck eggs and sell the chicken eggs to the Americans, you know, to make the money, the hard, you know, currency.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, whatever meat they could scrounge. We had two guys, Gupton and Waters, used to go out with a big seine, you know, these throw nets.
Mm-hmm.
You see the South Pacific Islanders use, and Mexican fishermen, throw nets, these huge throw nets, and they'd go out and catch the canals over there were brackish water canals. They were actually tidal.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go out and catch shrimp, bring them back. Every we'd have one night, taco night, old Spies.
Mm-hmm.
He's half German, half Mexican. He'd make tacos. And Gupton and Waters would go out and catch prawns, and we'd have shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
If you caught a python or something like that, you were in hog heaven, man. That was,
yeah.
You know, because they weighed up to 20 pounds, 50 pounds,
mm-hmm.
or bigger even. You know.
Mm-hmm. And good meat.
Good meat. All meat, you know, no fat.
Right.
And
what were some of the larger snakes that you saw?
I didn't see too many snakes in Long Phu, because it was mm-hmm. all, you know, rice paddy and, you know, I saw them after they were caught.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, I in live, by themselves,
mm-hmm.
The only thing I saw was cobras, and we had a pet python there
mm-hmm.
named Elizabeth. Was 21 feet long.
Wow. How did you keep Elizabeth there at the camp?
Oh, feathered chickens. Oh, she was in a big cage. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. And we had a monkey named Duke.
How did you find Duke?
Duke was, I forget who the hell he belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
But he might have belonged to the Vietnamese SF.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't like them. And he liked the Americans because they'd play with them and mm-hmm. give them a banana or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it got to the point where he couldn't stand our cook. We had a Chinese cook.
Uh-huh.
And he couldn't stand Charlie because Charlie's a number one chop chop. You know, he'd tell that to the monkey. The monkey'd go berserk. he knew that Charlie was smacking his lips. You know?
Uh-huh. Like he's going to eat the monkey.
Eat the monkey, yeah.
And the monkey knew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so Duke would go nuts.
He'd go crazy when Charlie came. Well, one time we fixed old Charlie up. You know, Duke had a chain. You know, he could only run so far. Charlie knew, you know. He only run so far.
So Duke, would Duke attack Charlie?
Oh, yeah. He got violent.
Okay.
Yeah. So we fixed old Charlie. We lengthened the chain on Duke. Charlie came over there antagonizing the monkey, and the monkey went after him, and he had an extra 4 foot of chain.
Uh-huh.
Got a hold of Charlie, and oh God,
what happened?
Between the Chinese and the monkey squealing, holy crap! You'd think it was a company over there fighting. But he never forgave us for that.
Uh huh. Okay.
But he learned a lesson.
Right. Okay, let's get back. We were talking about you're slogging through these rice paddies, and you're going to catch the NVA or the VC. Continue with that. How would that actually happen?
Well, there was a limited number of villages, and
mm-hmm.
you have to consider that some of these guys were just draft dodgers. They weren't really VC,
uh-huh.
you know, and they'd act like VC because they were evading us. You know, they were trying
mm-hmm.
to get away. You know,
mm-hmm.
but you couldn't tell the difference. We'd hit weigh stations. I mean, there'd be cauldrons of fish enough to feed a company.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know they had you know their scouts out as well as ours.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they found out we were coming and vacated.
Mm-hmm.
But there was enough there, you know, to feed a company.
Mm-hmm.
And they left a lot of stuff, but the majority of the weapons and stuff they either hid well or took off.
Mm-hmm.
And in this area. I don't know how many other teams ran into it, but these guys had firing positions at waterline level,
hmm.
where they could actually get into the bunker
mm-hmm.
on the bank of a canal
mm-hmm.
and be down to the waterline, where they could have grazing fire on the canal. And they eventually got they shot my replacement.
Hmm.
The boat was coming up to resupply the FOV and. Had three Americans and
mm-hmm.
the cook and the LLDB
mm-hmm.
and then I guess I'm not sure if they had indigenous behind them or what, but they ambushed the boat and shot Lindquist and they took the boat into Cambodia.
Really?
Yeah, but old Charlie Morrow and Lindquist and Fred the cook
mm-hmm.
all got into the elephant grass and. Buried their weapons, stuck all their weapons. When they ran out of ammo, they stuck all the weapons down into the mud,
mm-hmm.
muzzle first, so they couldn't find them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just hit out. Well, you know, the NVA or whoever the hell it was was gonna burn the elephant grass, try and get them, you know.
Right.
But this guy Fred, the cook, heroic little son of a gun. He's half Chinese, half Cambodian.
Mm-hmm.
He was with us in '63, and I went down to 4th Corps and got him, brought him up to Tuinya.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran all the way back to camp, tore him up. I mean, it was ripped. I mean, his whole body looked like he just got flayed with a whip.
Running through the elephant grass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he got back and he told America, says, ambush, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Bobby Kennedy was up at Makwa, the B team. And,
oh, yeah?
And he had a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And the operations, I can't remember his name, the operations officer at the B team took Kennedy's chopper and gave it to our people and let them fly recon to find out where the Americans were.
Mm-hmm.
So they eventually got them up and picked up the Americans, but the Charlie had already taken the boat and the motors and the guns and stuff and were heading for Cambodia.
Okay. Tell me about when you would actually go into a village. How would you conduct yourselves, and how would you search for weapons and rice and et cetera?
Well, it was kind of cut and dried. Ordinarily, unless they, you know, were superior to you, they'd vacate.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into a village, and obviously there'd be either kids playing or no kids playing, adult males or no adult males. That would strike you immediately.
Right.
But a lot of these villages that's what happened, you know, that... they might have an uncle in the Viet Cong or an NVA or whatever, but you know, it's hard to describe. It's just something that you feel and you look for.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, you go in and you surround the thing if you can, first of all, and then you get in and start looking. And if it's a bad place, then you destroy it.
How would the villagers react to you being there?
Most of the time, they were happy to see you. Because, you know, you're going to go in and, you know, they have stuff for sale. They got fresh fruit, pickled eggs or blutes or whatever. And they used to have these little pieces of ham, spiced ham. They'd wrap it up in banana leaf. Used to buy those just to supplement your diet.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time you were well received, either, you know, feigned, you know, or sincere. It didn't matter, you know, because once we moved in, we took over.
Right.
And then, but we never usually stayed in the village for long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was already set up that, you know, the intelligence people would know in advance usually who to talk to, and they might, you know, take everybody into the center of the village and talk to everybody just so they don't blow the cover of the guy they want to talk to. You know, it all depends on if it was definitely a hostile village you were going into. But mainly you're out looking for not stuff that's identified. You know, they got little mini villages that they build under the canopy that you can't see, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you chance on and hope to run into.
Mm-hmm.
And
how much of a problem were booby traps?
Well, I stepped on a booby trap. I stepped on a mine in '65.
Did you really?
But it was my fault because I was out in front where I shouldn't have been. I should have been back where I belong. And I stepped on a toe popper. And, scared the hell out of me. Scared the hell out of the people behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know how many were around, or you know. So everybody, you know, took immediate action. But luckily, I had those steel inserts in my boot. So all I got was, you know, rocks and mud blown up in my face and my crotch and knocked me on the ground. But
this was during this tour?
During the tour, second tour, yeah.
Right. What kind of weapons did you carry?
We had M16s.
This was the first model M16,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. And
AR-15s or whatever.
Did you have problems with the jamming?
Not really. Actually, probably most of the guys put their M16s in the arms room and got an M1.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. More reliable?
Well, at long distance.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, you got anywhere from one or two companies. You know, you could have up to, 150, 200 men
mm-hmm.
on one operation, depending on, you know, how important it was
mm-hmm.
and what you had to do. Or you'd have four Americans running two companies and then get a pincher going or a hammer and anvil or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on whatever we wanted to accomplish.
Right.
But a lot of guys, one guy liked the BAR.
Mm-hmm.
He had excellent knockdown power, excellent distance. You know, you could fire forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people, you know, wanted the M16 for, you know, close-in. People carried shotguns. Mm-hmm. Or a combination. M79, we had the M79 mm-hmm. grenade launcher at that mm-hmm. time. And that was really helpful.
What was your favorite weapon?
I like the 105 howitzer myself. If I could get him with a howitzer, I'd feel better about it.
Okay, and what was your favorite personal weapon?
Yeah, I carried an M16.
Because uh-huh.
It was enough, you know, if you're halfway decent shot, you know, and, you know, if he was that far off, he wasn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
Bothering me any, so.
Mm-hmm.
But you had the choice of automatic and semi-automatic. Ammo was light. You could carry a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, I carried medical stuff, and I, you know, grenades and then smoke and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It can get pretty heavy.
Were there any weapons that you did not have that you wish you did have?
Not really, that I can think of. At that time, we were pretty well armed because,
mm-hmm.
Like I say, the M79 grenade launcher was really, really nice because it covered the distance between you throwing a hand grenade and dropping an 81 mortar round out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys on the team, old Rudy Cooper, he took a picture when the CIDG, the companies, had 60 millimeter mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And each man would carry two rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cooper's a camera fanatic. And what they do is they, being the Delta and all, and the ground is really, you know, wet, soggy, you know, mm-hmm. they'd get a piece of bamboo log, and they'd set that down, you know, on flat side down,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd set the small base plate on the M60. They'd set that on a bamboo, but they'd still have the bipod legs in the front for stability and getting, a right aim.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cooper was taking his picture, and they fired the round, and he caught the mortar about a foot off the ground where the projectile had left,
mm-hmm.
but the recoil was enough to bounce off that banana log
mm-hmm.
and bounce the thing up in the air. But that was really effective. That was really good. Mm-hmm. That 60-millimeter mortar was a godsend because,
mm-hmm.
like I say, the troops carried two or three rounds each,
mm-hmm.
you know, in addition to what their personal armor.
Right, right. Tell me about the enemy now in 1965. What was your general impression of the Viet Cong and MPA?
More organized, better equipped, more numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't afraid to move in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, what we learned later was the sanctuary right there at the Fishhook.
Mm-hmm.
That was, we were 16 clicks. Due south of the Fishhook.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I say, better equipped, better better trained, more politically, I guess, motivated.
Mm-hmm.
They hit one of our outposts within 150 yards of camp, killed all the Sij, and got away clean.
Hmm.
Brassy, you know. There was a small village up the canal and up the river from us. They had a Vietnamese priest up there, Brother Louis.
Mm-hmm.
He had a church and a little village built around it, you know, the local Catholics and
mm-hmm.
all. They raided his place several times. And a lot more brassy, a lot more. They didn't realize, I don't think, at first, how bad a detriment we were going to be. Because
mm-hmm.
we covered that area pretty well, and we had good intel nets and a lot of agents
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people that just got fed up with the bad folks and came across.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some pretty good information, and we were actually just south of where the district chief lived. So he was secure, so he could do things to, you know, to get out and get things done. And,
mm-hmm.
and get some information. So we had a pretty good intel net.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, you know, we could move. They gave us more airboats. We had more engineer patrol boats.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the Navy sent down some riverine brown water Navy folks.
Mm-hmm.
And they would use the big canals or the LaGrange Canal and the Songbankote River.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easy for them to navigate there. But we'd, you know, use the airboats and the estuaries and the smaller streams. And
mm-hmm.
and actually, they worked on wet ground, you know, on the rice paddies and all.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break just for a moment. I need to change this disc out.
Sure.
Okay. How frustrating was it for you to have those sanctuaries right there, for them to be able to run right into Cambodia, and you could not really chase them?
Well, we did chase them.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't chase them in force.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to draw us a few times. But, you know, it was... we didn't know the extent of a sanctuary it was,
mm-hmm.
how much they had sandbagged back there,
mm-hmm.
all the supplies and the armament and the trails and the stuff that were, I think 65 and 66 is actually when we started sending some round eyes across the border,
mm-hmm.
and finding this stuff out. They had, you know, agent reports and stuff like that, but, I mean, really, you know, the extent that, these folks had taken over Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't bother us because, we had probes. We were so strong and confident. And again, we had five companies, I think, in this camp.
Mm-hmm.
And in this camp, we had four deuce mortars instead of the 81. We did have 81s also, but the four deuce could punch out around a lot further.
Mm-hmm.
So within the villages of the screen of our mortars, we could at least get illumination and HE within minutes of learning that they were under attack or there was something going on.
Mm-hmm.
Each man was cross-trained in firing the mortar, aiming the mortar, and, you know, cutting charges and setting fuses and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever was in the camp, that was a secondary mission, is supported the villages and then around us. But we could offset that four-deuce mortar and move it down to the district chief's house,
mm-hmm.
and add another, say, three or five clicks,
mm-hmm.
to the range, you know,
mm-hmm.
which you know, Charlie didn't expect.
Right.
And it helped out. Plus, we improvised. I think they were firing the 60-millimeter mortar from the engineer patrol boats,
mm-hmm.
getting a layer of sandbags,
mm-hmm.
so they could, you know, go a mile and be firing, you know,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, go the mile, take it off, and go into the bush and fire it.
Right.
So artillery support, even if it was only a 60-millimeter mortar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had, again, that M79 grenade launcher. We used that for recon by fire on the canals.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, that was really perturbed me was the fact that they could get grazing fire at waterline level.
Right.
And that was disturbing, especially when you were driving the boat.
Right. How did you counter that?
Well, you just surrounded yourself with good people. Because the airboats, the directional was, if I remember correctly, the left hand was the accelerator. It was kind of like the old-fashioned emergency brake.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the right handle was for steering.
Mm-hmm.
And they had foot controls like an airplane for the main flap in the back.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you could be clipping along a healthy pace. And those things, you could hit a berm and go airborne for about 50 feet.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What was the top speed?
Oh, well, let me tell you. You know what an L-19 Bird Dog is?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that was an L-19 Bird Dog engine on a small boat.
Wow.
So,
okay.
The L-19 was so damn overpowered, it killed people.
Uh-huh.
But,
so quite fast.
Yeah, it would move.
How big was the boat?
The boat was, I'm going to say 16 foot, but it might have been 18.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, they had twin 30s mounted on the front, most
mm-hmm.
of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget how many indige we had, but we'd have probably at least a fire team, mm-hmm. probably maybe even a squad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. During this time in 65, this is when the Americans actually started coming en masse to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Did you sense a change in the population of South Vietnam, or did you sense a change in the pace of the war?
Yeah, because we started paying attention to them,
mm-hmm.
What they were doing. The 82nd, I think, was the... I went in for a food run into Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and the 82nd Aviation Detachment, I think, was just arriving, and, you know, seeing a bunch of guys in starch fatigues and stuff, you know, I mean, really starch fatigue,
mm-hmm.
not rice starch.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing a bunch of Americans and then hearing what they were going to be doing, and, you know, that changed things.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, about where we were, you know, it was, you know, we have an American unit, possibly, you know, I think the 9th Division came through one time, element of the 9th Division came through.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we started paying more attention to what Americans were doing in the war than what we were doing in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, everything got expensive downtown. You know, if you went into Saigon,
mm-hmm.
hotels went up and the price of money went down, or, you know, the money exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, typically. But we were, you know, they were welcome. We were glad to see them.
Right, right.
Especially the aviation units, because that was our bread and butter was...
Mm-hmm. Sir, why don't we go ahead and take a break for today?
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you.